Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Story to tell you about this morning, a racist incident last night at an NHL preseason game in London, Ontario. This morning, the whole hockey world is reacting, and Michael Serapio is going to bring us all of the details. First of all, before we get to the reaction, Michael, the story of what happened here.
Well, and we should say we don't know if this was meant as an ignorant jest or meant to be a malicious jest. What we can tell you is it is being interpreted as racist and reverberating through the hockey world this morning. Now, what we're talking about here is an exhibition game that took place last night in London, Ontario at the John Labatt Centre. The Philadelphia Flyers playing the Detroit Red Wings in a game that ended in a tie. Now, the game was tied by Flyers forward Wayne Simmonds, originally from Toronto and one of the few black players in the NHL. And when the game was forced into a shootout, as Simmonds was approaching the Detroit net, someone from the upper decks threw a banana onto the ice. It landed within a couple of metres of Simmonds, and while he ignored it and went on to score, no one could escape the racist undertones of the gesture. Bananas have been used in Europe to demean soccer players of color, implying they are like monkeys. Simmonds says he doesn't know if the banana had anything to do with the fact that he is black, but he also went on to say when you are black, you learn to expect these racist gestures and you learn to deal with it. Of course, no matter how diplomatic he is being, it does not make it excusable, Heather.
That is his reaction, classy and all. What has the reaction elsewhere been, Michael?
Well, as you say, very classy reaction from Simmonds' part, but others have been very quick to rush to his side and expressing disgust. Let's begin with CBC hockey commentator Kevin Weeks. He tweeted this last night. I'm extremely disappointed. As I speak, Willie O'Ree and I are in D.C. attending the Black Congressional Caucus on behalf of the NHL, and ironically, this takes place. From Logan Couture, center for the San Jose Sharks, who is from London, Ontario. Wayne Simmonds is a good friend of mine. To hear what happened tonight to him in my hometown is awful. No need for this in sport or life. And also from the LA Times this morning, because Simmonds used to play for the LA Kings. Hockey's locker rooms are overwhelmingly white, but the only colors that should matter are the players' jerseys, not their skin. No one should have to put up with the garbage Simmonds faced. And the writer goes on to say, Heather, that hockey fans and as human beings, we should all be better than this.
Hear, hear. Michael, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The Cows, Gusty Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy, what it is, how it works. Today's date, Thursday, April 21st, 2016. So I have been told we should be here tomorrow. New book, book club, a brand new book, Harriet Washington, Medical Apartheid. Thanks to all the folks who participated in our book club over the years, particularly people who voted. We were supposed to do Medical Apartheid at the end of 2015, but we had difficulties getting the audio together to do that book. All of that has been taken care of. We have the audio. We will be getting the book tomorrow. That was our number one vote getter. So all the folks who were excited and looking forward to doing Medical Apartheid, your patience shall be rewarded. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, tomorrow evening, Medical Apartheid, extremely important book in my view. Anyone, any black person who's serious about racism should read that book in detail. Take great notes. Looking forward to getting that off the ground tomorrow. Our broadcast for today, always extremely important, in my opinion, to study racism, white supremacy as a global system. I think a lot of times when we are dealing with racism, people end up talking about it as though this is just a problem in a few places. Maybe, you know, in Mississippi or in the South, Alabama, a few areas. Maybe in South Africa, this has been a problem from time to time. But certainly this is not the dominant system on the planet. And I could not disagree more vehemently. That is the major problem on the planet. And I think we should always be making an effort to be looking at it from a global perspective. I think a lot of people are familiar with everything that's been happening in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, the Black Lives Matter movement. They've been doing a lot to call attention to racism in that area of the world, police brutality, a lot of the same issues that have been getting a lot of attention in the States over the last 2 years or so, 2-3 years. With Andrew Locu more recently on the protests in front of the police precinct, and they have an inquest going now to try to get details on what happened with the shooting and the officers' names and what have you. Hopefully we'll have more information to come on that as we move forward. We have even had members of the Black Lives Toronto movement on this program within the last year and a half or so to talk about issues north of the border. As I was doing research to figure out what was happening in Toronto, I stumbled on a documentary film dealing with racism in London, Ontario, Canada. For folks, just quick geography, London, Ontario is about midway between Detroit, Michigan and Toronto, Canada. I think it's about 192 kilometers for folks stateside. That's about 120 miles, about a two-hour drive from Toronto. It is a rather large city. It's about it's more than 300,000 people, so it's a pretty nice-sized city in Ontario. They don't have a whole lot of black people, but they do have a pretty interesting history and tradition of black people migrating to that area of the world. I found this film, Finding Freedom in the Forest City, about a month ago. They were doing the screening, and they had different photographs of some of the folks that were in the film, the filmmakers, and talking about the history of racism in this area of the world. Thought it would be great to get them on the program to discuss their film project and racism north of the border. They were willing to come speak with us. Should be grand to hear some of their thoughts this evening. We have with us the filmmakers, Miss Justine Turner and Mr. Mark Drew. They should both be joining us live from Canada. Are you both with us?
Yes, we are.
Outstanding. So glad to have both of you with us this Thursday evening. I guess we'll start with Miss Justine Turner. Anything that you think would be important for our listeners to know about who you are, the work that you do?
Oh, first of all, Gus, I want to thank you that, you know, you found us, found this film that myself and Mark Drew put together. And, excuse me, it's a... this film is all about love. And what I want to say is, first and foremost, you know, today is a special day, and every day is a special day. But, you know, you wake up every day, you know, there's always something happening, good or bad. And talking about, you know, racism, black and white, there was a gentleman that, you know, who passed and away, Prince Rogers Nelson, and that man had no color. And I grew up with him, you know, in the 80s. I mean, that was the guy, him and Michael Jackson. MJ is my man, and so is Prince. But, you know, when it comes to color and racism, there's no color with him. And I just want to say, first and foremost, he made an impact to me and how he was a motivation for me. You know, his music, and I, you know, I just want to say that I'm sad that he's gone from us. I know he's going to, you know, his legacy is going to live on, and I just pray he rests in peace with our Almighty God. So I just thank you that you found us, and again, this film's about love, and I'll give it to Mark Drew.
I'm Mark, and, you know, for our film, I brought together a lot of the technical side. You know, I did the cinematography and the editing and so on, and I was with Justine at the front when we were interviewing each and every person that we ended up getting in the film, but you know, I also have another project as well that deals with Black history, you know, so I've been dealing with this type of subject matter locally in London, you know, for the better part of the last 2 years, you know, within it. And then, you know, as an outsider, kind of observing and learning about the past and the present, you know, probably for about the last 6 or 7 years. So, you know, I feel like for a long time, this is what all I've been talking about with everyone. So it's really great to, you know, talk to some like-minded individuals about this kind of subject matter. So I'm happy to be here.
For sure. For people who have not, and it's linked in the description for the program, you can see both of the filmmakers, our guests with us this evening. You can see what they look like. But for folks that haven't seen you, Mr. Drew, you are a white man. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah, I have an English heritage background. Both my parents are born and bred in England, and they immigrated to Canada in the 70s. And then I was born in Canada about a decade later.
Okay. And might be a slightly more lengthy answer from Ms. Turner. Your racial classification, Ms. Turner?
I am mulatta. I'm biracial, so I'm, they say half black, half white, so I'm mulatta.
Mm-hmm. You have a black father and a white mother, is that correct?
Correct. That's correct. Yes, that's right.
Okay. And people looking at your photograph, because this came up, some of our listeners, when I was giving out the description for the program and telling them to go check out so they could see the documentary, they saw the photograph,
yeah.
And a lot of the folks that saw you, and they were like, this is Miss Turner, the woman in the front here? And I was like, yep, that's her. And they were like, wow, she looks like a white woman. And I said, that's what I said. Your response
mm-hmm,
to that?
Mm-hmm. My response is that I am who I am. I am, you know, I am a product of my mother and my father, you know. So because my parents, who my father's black and my mother's Caucasian, you know, and they made beautiful babies, three children, you know, and they may not have a color, you know, and perhaps my color is porcelain, but I am who I am. And as I talked to you last week, Gus, you know, I tell this to everybody. And of course, it comes through with all my work I've done since I was a child. I don't take on the arena. You know, I'm white in this arena. I'm black in this arena. I am Justine Turner. So I am a product of my parents, and I'm very proud of that. So when someone looks at my photographs, Gus, and I'm, you know, it's really funny. It's kind of an irony, actually, because that's kind of racism in itself. Because they look at, oh, she looks white. But if anyone has any of an idea of someone who is biracial, which is a 21st century term, they would see the person's, you know, facial, their whole entire sculpture of their face. Because I know, as I mentioned to you last week, I know exactly the person who is mulatta. Nevertheless, though, I mean, look, I've had that talk told to me so many times. And, but, you know, it's really unfair because I'm doing this because I have a heart and passion of people that I grew up with as an infant, you know, and I was bred into this beautiful history. Of course, my paternal history, which I was very much exposed to, which probably 90% of my life, and my mother's history. However, I was more so involved in my paternal history, and thus this is why we're talking right now. But bottom line, you know your whole platform is about racism, and as I told you, this film is not about racism. Yes, we talk about it because you can't ignore that. And you mentioned about white supremacy. Excuse me. But you know, to label me, oh, you're a white girl, and I get that a lot, especially when I go to the United States, which is really unfair. And so, you know, I'm here to talk, to say I am very proud of who I am. I'm proud that, you know what, my father is an American man. His ancestry comes from the West Indies. I'm proud of my mother. Her ancestry come from Scotland and Ireland and actually Britain. But so, yeah, here I am.
Right on. Appreciate the elaboration in the answer. One of the things on this program.
No, you're welcome.
For sure. One of the things on this program, we are very much about being accurate, particularly anything that's even close to an accusation. No one said that you were a white girl. What I said was that the photograph, I said, oh, this looks like a white woman. That's not even calling you a white girl. It's just saying this looks like someone who could be classified as white. And we'll make sure we ask her about that on the program. And I'd already talked to you about that on the program. But we are very, very cautious about anything that's sounding like an accusation, particularly if it's inaccurate or something that someone actually did not say. Very careful about words on the program. I also wanted to just check to make sure if I heard you correctly. Did you say that that is a form of racism, saying that just looking at your photograph and saying phenotypically this looks like someone who would be classified as white? Did you say that's a
yes,
form of racism?
Yes, I did say that.
Can you explain what you mean when you say that?
Because when you look at my picture, you're saying, okay, well, this girl says she's mulatta or biracial, whatever you want to call me, right? But she looks like she's white. So from your perspective, you're saying, okay, well, I guess this person should be looking like she's black of color. So that's from my observation and my interpretation. So that's how I'm feeling.
Okay. Well, for me, we just have to start with number one. I guess I can just go to my definition and then we can come back to this. On this program, again, as I've said, definitions, words are very, very important. I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. I use them as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. I will ask both of you, I'll start with Mr. Drew, do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Of whites active, like a network, I suppose, of whites that is working actively to subjugate other races, regardless, you know, of them. I'd say I'd say it's like a systemic thing. Yeah, there certainly is racism, and there certainly would be some sort of, I'd say, global problem of discrimination. Maybe, I guess you could call it racism. I would consider it more of a discrimination issue where discrimination, right, can take many forms and doesn't necessarily have to be specifically one race saying something or treating another race as inferior. I would say that discrimination is people treating other people as inferiors. And that, I would totally agree, is a global problem.
Okay. I just want to hang on here. We're trying to be just getting accuracy, just getting truth. It's been my experience a lot of times when you bring up racism, people have a difficult time just being honest, being truthful about things.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't ask about discrimination. I didn't ask about prejudice. If you don't agree, that's fine. You can just say that. It's no problem. We can move forward, and I'll get Ms. Turner's comment to the definition. If you like, I can give you my definition again, but it's very important because I did not use the term discrimination. I did not use the term prejudice, and I certainly didn't say one group mistreating other races. I definitely didn't see that, and all those things are important because, as I keep emphasizing, words are very important when we're discussing racism. So my definition,
absolutely,
a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate, Mr. Drew?
Yes.
That's right.
I'm sorry, I got some feedback there. Mr. Drew, your response was...
Oh, sorry, I said parts of that definition I 100% agree with. I mean, I guess that'd be splitting hairs, just, you know, the way in semantics. I would say generally I agree with that definition.
What part do you not agree with?
Well, you say, like, a group of whites that identify as white working universally, I guess, against anyone non-white to subjugate or to, subjugate was the word, correct?
Yes, sir.
I would say, yeah, you know, it's saying that it's white in that sense, I would say maybe is boiling it down to make it seem like all whites would be that way, where I think it is a very small group of whites that act that way and ruin it for the rest. You know, ruin that definition, I suppose, for the rest.
That's interesting. That's interesting. All righty. Miss Turner, same question to you. If you need me to repeat the definition, I can do so. But do you think the definition...
No, I'm gonna have to, like, actually write it down completely. Because, I mean, Mark, God bless him, a global system of what?
A global system of people who classify...
Okay, 1 second. Of people who classify...
themselves as white.
1 second. Themselves as white.
And are dedicated...
And are dedicated
to abusing and mm-hmm. or subjugating
and are subjugating
everyone in the known mm-hmm. universe whom they classify as not white.
Okay, so a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing or subjugating everyone in the known universe who...
they classify as not white.
Who they classify as not white. Well, you know what? There is racism in the world, for sure. And to answer this question, wow. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing or subjugating everyone in the known universe who they classify as not white, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
You know, with all due respect, Gus, I'm trying to get my mind around this statement. From what I feel from this, what you're saying, your statement that you just, and thank you for, you know, take your time to give me it word by word. There are, this world is 100% there's racism, you know. To answer your question, so the question is what? Because this is a statement, really, right?
No, the question is, that is my definition for racism, white supremacy. The question is, do you think that such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate? That is the question.
I think there's some people that think that actually do. To answer your question, yes, I believe that there are people out there that do have that mindset.
We're not really asking if some people have that mindset. We're asking if that definition is accurate. Do we see a global system of people who classify themselves as white, who are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white? Do we see that in existence right now? And again, if you don't, like I said, this is, you know, it's not trying to, if you don't agree, no problem. I just want to make sure that everyone is clear where we stand on that definition of racism, because that's very important. It's been my experience that frequently, I would say almost it's invariable, when people talk about racism, either people don't give a definition or everyone acts like we have the same definition. And I found that often people have very different definitions for racism. So it's important to at least get that out in the open. This is my definition. If you don't agree, no problem. But at least we all know where we're coming from at the beginning of the program before we hop into the subject matter.
Yeah. Okay. You know what? I don't agree with that completely. No,
fine.
I don't.
Fine. No problem. What parts do you not agree with?
I don't agree with the fact that, you know, there's a global system of people that classify themselves as white. I agree there's a movement in this world that is open. There's like an aura that's opening up with people want to know so much things, education, especially when it comes to humanity and spirituality. So, no. I think this is about negativity and hatred. And I don't believe in that. I believe in our the ones that came before us. And I mean, I'm going to talk about the United States for a second. Robert Kennedy, he said negative breeds negative, positive breeds positive. So, now I don't believe in that, because when I grew up, I didn't see color, nor did my brother see color. You know, I saw my mother, I saw my father. That was my parents. I saw my aunts, my uncles, my grandparents. So no, you know, we go to school. You know, you opens up a little, you know, obviously a total different demographic obviously you're in another level of life. But you go home and, you know, you're home and your parents tell you, like, that's how they were taught. So no.
Okay.
This world is all about love.
Okay.
Period. We're all one race. Thank you for
you're
answering. Welcome.
I appreciate it. Thank you for the response. I do want to get in. This is another one that's important, and I try to get this across to our listeners on a regular basis. Frequently, people say things when we're talking about racism that are just clearly false. Sometimes I think people do it just because a lot of times people just repeat a lot of rhetoric. They repeat things that they've heard when they're talking about racism, and it might sound good, but I mean, it's clearly false. It's the same thing as someone telling you that the sky is, you know, purple. That is clearly not true. or even we can be more outrageous that, you know, the sky is polka dot or magenta or something. It's clearly not true. Mm-hmm. When people say that they do not see color, unless you're colorblind, unless you're telling me that you have to get somebody to come in and match your socks up and, you know, get your makeup straight and make sure you don't go out the house looking crazy, I know you see color. When people say that and they're talking about racism, I can only conclude that they are not being truthful. They might be trying to just completely lie to me, or at minimum, they're saying things that are simply not true. There's no way you even started the conversation saying, Prince, there's no color. Glass has no color. If we're talking about anything else, there's color. You wouldn't be able to see it if there was no color. It would be transparent. Prince clearly has color. He is someone who's identified as not white and who talked about racism being a problem in his life. Your parents clearly have color. And the reason I give out my definition, I've concluded we are on a planet where racial classifications, the color, the pigment, the melanin in your skin, it's present, people see it, and you get classified and mistreated on that basis if you have a little bit too much melanin in your skin. Now, either that's true or it's not, but I've concluded, and in my opinion, it's blatant, it's obvious, it's glaring. You cannot miss it, and a good bit of it comes up in your film, Finding Freedom in the Forest City, racism being a problem worldwide, even in London, Ontario. Just want to make sure I get that out for listeners. Anytime you hear somebody say that, I mean, that should be immediate. You should not be allowed to just have that ride in a conversation on racism that I don't see color or there's no color, because it's simply not true. And the person at worst, they could just be lying to you blatantly. With this,
guys, let me tell you something. I did not see color in my family. Okay.
Let you know said that a couple times.
You didn't.
I don't agree.
No, I'm going to tell you again.
Hang on a second.
Hang on a second. We talked before about finding freedom in the forest.
That's
city,
great.
Okay?
We're going to talk about the film.
I did not.
We're
going
to talk about the film, Ms. Turner. But you can't interrupt. I have allowed both of you to speak, and I have not interrupted you. You cannot just interrupt and jump in. And as I said, clearly, if you want to go back to your father, we can make time to do that. But you cannot, you know, hop in and interrupt. I'm going to respect both of you.
You go ahead. I'll do respect. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Particularly for something, as I said, that is not true. People can see your father in the film. He gives some of his background about growing up in Ontario. They can see him. That, I mean, it's a false statement, in my opinion. Now, with the film, and some of this, we can even go back to your classification about what you said about you being, quote unquote, biracial. You used a lot of different terms, talking about having a black father and a white mother and how that impacts your experience. And even saying that you felt it was racism for people to look at your photograph and say, oh, I think that's a white girl, or I think that's someone who would be classified as white, and saying that that's racism right there. I would just say what I've heard from you and what I saw in the film is the type of thing that I generally hear when I hear white people talk about racism, making the sort of statements, the rhetoric that they don't see color and that it's all love and that we're all one human race. Those are the type of responses that I generally hear from individuals who are classified as white when they're just, in my view, not speaking honestly about racism. Do you think it's valid in any way? Because I think you did say that you've heard from many people. It's not like this is the first time that you've heard it. Someone seeing you or seeing a photograph of you and saying, oh, I think this is someone who's classified as white. You did say that, right?
I did many times. Okay. I get that all the time, actually.
Okay. So do
I did tell you that. You're
do
right.
Do you think it's valid that an individual, a black person, and I mean someone who is black, the color of Andrew Locu, or someone who's black like Desmond Cole, or someone who's...
I don't know who Andrew Locu is.
The black male in Toronto who was shot and killed by police. They said he had a hammer. That's what the Black Lives Matter in Toronto, that's what they've been protesting about for the past weeks in Toronto. Someone who's his complexion, someone the complexion of Lupita Nyong'o, to look at you, do you think it's valid for them to just see your photograph if they don't know anything about your background, they haven't seen your film and the photos with your father and everything? Do you think it's valid to say, hey, I think this is someone who might be a white person? Maybe I'll ask. Do you think that's valid? Do you think that's logical?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Let me move forward, though. You mentioned that about when they saw my picture, like, oh, yeah, this is a girl we saw. She looks like she's white, and she's doing a film on black history. That gave me the impression that, okay, so they wanted a person of color to doing a film on black history. Okay.
Say that again, please.
You're saying at the beginning that people saw my photograph and they said, this girl looks like she's white.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you're like, they were wondering like how she's white and she's doing a film on black history. So, you know, that's why I said to you, that doesn't make any sense to me. Why would you judge my skin, my color, as why I'm doing what I do?
Oh, no, that wasn't, I didn't say anything in relation to the film. We have done nearly 1,500 programs. We have had truckloads of white people who have written books or done documentaries dealing with racism, and from all over the world, all different types of subject matter. So, I mean, you would not be the first, you would not even be the 50th person that we've talked to that's white. And has decided that they want to do a project on racism. It's just something that I think is important to point out to know. Am I talking to someone who's classified as white, or am I talking to a non-white person? That is important, good information to know. Second, with regards to the film, at least the people that saw it, I don't think anybody said, why is this white woman doing a film on race? It was more, in a system of racism, white supremacy, sometimes racial classifications, and it seems growing, that there's a lot of confusion. I don't know if you saw the situation with Rachel Dolezal, because that was in the States. I don't know if you all heard about that up in Canada, but that was, it was a female, a white woman. She had two white parents, but she had been telling people that she was black. And she was getting jobs. Okay. She was getting jobs on this basis and working for the NAACP and this sort of thing. And when all of this came out, people felt like they had been lied to. People felt like she had deceived them and that this was really incorrect behavior on her part. And there's some other examples of this as well, where individuals there's a long history of passing as well, where you've had individuals who maybe they had a white parent and a non-white parent, and they just said, forget it. This racism, white supremacy thing is a big problem. if I can be accepted as white, I'm just going to do that and go ahead and live my life. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a big deal. There's lots of scholarship on this in terms of people having ambiguous racial identities, and sometimes non-white people get fooled. So for me, as someone, this is not an option for me. There's no way that I can, quote unquote, pass. There's no ambiguity. There's no confusion about my classification. It's something that's very important to be clear. And as I asked you, it's logical for people to see your photograph or to see you in person or what have you, to have some questions like, hey, wait a minute, is she white? What's going on here? And I think for people here, because some of the comments that people did say, when they see someone like a President Obama who says, hey, I have a white mom and a black father, he does not look like someone who could just go out and be accepted as a white person. He looks radically mm-hmm. different from you. So a lot of people that saw the photographs, they just had serious questions. And as I asked you, you said it was logical.
It is logical. As I said to you before, we talked last week, Gus, and I just mentioned too in our interview a few minutes ago, that I have a lot of people that do know people that look mulatta, and they identify me, especially when I went to school mm. in Toronto. And I mean, it was actually a really nice, it was a breath of fresh air, because I would have black students come up to me that I don't even know, and they'd come up to me in the halls, and they'd say, are you Jamaican? Because the majority of people in Toronto were Jamaican. I said, my ancestry is West Indian. I go, why do you ask that question? And they said, because you look like you're half black, because I am. And I said, how'd you know that? I said, they said, because of your facial, your features. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I grew up in a family, like, you know, where there's so many different colors. And like my uncle, for example, you know, he married a Caucasian lady. And my cousin, his daughter, her and I always look like sisters. She's about 4 years older than me, but so you would identify with that. And so there are people that can see it. There's people that cannot see it. And especially in the States, they can see it 100%.
Has there ever been a time where you consciously have allowed yourself to be accepted as a white person, or even told people that you were a white person for any sort of personal benefit?
Never. And I'm really ashamed of you to ask me that question. I would never do that, ever.
I don't know. Again, some of this, the defensiveness, that like,
why
to
would
me
you
it does not.
No, why would you answer that question?
I'll answer your question. No problem. But this sort of defensiveness, this is the sort of thing that I generally get and expect from white people that are practicing racism. Now, I'll answer your question.
Oh, my God.
Because there is a long history of that being done. I just told you there's tons. You can go and get
dissertations.
Hang on, you're interrupting
okay?
again. Hang on, you're interrupting again. I'm answering your question. It seems Mr. Drew, he understands this. He knows this. There's a lot of scholarship. This is not like you would be the first person who has been able to, quote unquote, pass to be accepted in white and done so when it would benefit them. I'm submitting racism is a major problem on this planet, and that I could totally understand the logic of someone who's saying, hey, if I could be accepted as white and get any benefits, get any goodies on that basis, I will do so. If I can avoid some problems that might happen to me as a result of racism, if I can do that by being accepted as white, if these folks think I'm white just based on my phenotypical presentation, my lack of melanin, I will do so. That has happened many, many, many times mm-hmm. throughout the world. Mr. Drew acknowledging Absolutely. And you responding in that way. Again, I can only say that's the type of thing I expect and generally get from white people practicing racism. This is not any sort of personal thing against you. I mean, it's just this is not the first time that I've seen this. These are questions that I would ask to anybody who came on this program I was having any sort of honest dialogue with who looked like you, had the parents that you do. We're talking about this. These are the type of questions that I would ask. And I would just hope that they could answer honestly without all of the defensiveness and that sort of thing. Because, I mean, these are logical questions. There's a lot of history on this.
I think anyone would be defensive when that's a derogatory question. Because I'm proud of who I am. So regarding your percentage of, you know, people that you talk to, of course I'm going to have my back up. I've never walked into any arena, for lack of a better word, I'm white today, I'm black today. I am Justine, okay? I am my mother and my father. They made me. And as I told you last week when I spoke to you, when I was in the States, many times they say, you know what, your father's black, so you're a black person. I said, black girl. I said, no, I'm not. I said, I am a mulatta. I am my mother and my father, okay? So whether your statistics, well, you know what? Those statistics have nothing to do with me.
That's fine. No problem. Again, I would just ask those questions.
But Mr. Drew or Mark Drew just said, okay, but Mark is not me. So he can't answer that question.
I didn't ask him. I asked you. You answered. No problem.
I know, but you mentioned his comment, okay?
No problem. Again, I appreciate the answer. I will only submit again, and I'm sure our listeners are very familiar. Maybe you wouldn't do that, but many, many, many people have, and it is extremely valid. And I would encourage any of our listeners, these are the type of questions you should ask and in a calm manner, not being rude, not being nasty, just questions to ask, because there is a lot of documented, substantiated history of people who have done exactly that, where they could pass as white and they did, or even if they switched back and forth as it was convenient for them to do so. Long documented history, way before we even got to Rachel Dolezal. Now with the film, I'll switch back to Mr. Drew since I feel like I've been talking to Ms. Turner quite a bit. With this film project, I guess, how did you get on board? You said you did a lot of, I guess, the cinematography and what have you, editing background stuff. How did you get on board for this project?
Well, Justine actually gave me a call a couple of years ago talking about how she had this idea to interview a lot of the black people that were in London and area. And I mean, obviously being her family connection, right, she had an in with the community. The story really intrigued me. I was interested. Like I said, I've been researching the slave history and London's connection to it through the Civil War and before anyways. So I've been involved in at least the research side of things, trying to understand sort of the way multiculturalism was born, or at least the ideals of it that are considered in Canada as being a multicultural country. That was where I came from. And when Justine was talking to me on the phone about going and interviewing these people that are still alive and talking about their experiences, I guess it would be as black people, but I think the film is more showing that even though they're black, they're people first and black second, I suppose. You know, that's kind of what the film is trying to point out. So we went and interviewed people, and, you know, to be honest, I think Justine would agree in this scenario, we didn't really know what we had until we were about two-thirds of the way through when we started realizing the people we had interviewed. You know, everyone was bringing some kind of valid story, some kind of valid insight, some unique perspective, you know, through their stories of their lives, that, you know, could all be contributed into the, I guess, the definition black culture in London. And, you know, as we went on, you see the results through the documentary itself is the collection of these stories. So, it was a phone call. A phone call got me involved, and I was convinced. And then, like I said, I already had a lot of the technical background. I've been working as a filmmaker locally since about my whole life, I would say, but professionally for at least the last 6 years. So it was kind of a natural fit.
What the documentary, I guess it's about an hour or so. What was the budget that you all were working with on the project? I guess either of you can take that one.
Low. A lot of it was funded out of pocket by Justine, and there was some sponsors involved, but I mean, the budget for what you see on screen, people don't believe us when we say we did it for less than $10,000, but we did.
Wow. And like how long, like in terms of, months or years went into producing this?
2 years worth of time, effort, and interviews.
2 years. Wow. Okay. And I guess I'll pitch this one to Justine. Is it accurate? You can set me straight if I'm incorrect. The film, to me, it seems like an effort to kind of show, because the statistics that I saw, and you can set me straight on this too, I think London, Ontario has has slightly more than 300,000 population, slightly more than 300,000.
Mm-hmm. 380,000 people. 380,000, almost 400,000 people.
Close to 400,000 people, from what I saw online. Less than 3% classified as black. Is that accurate to your knowledge?
No, it'd be more than that.
More than that? What do you think it is?
I would say the black race in Mother Ontario.
People that would be classified as black, yeah. People that would be classified as black.
I would say about
25%. Wow, okay. I looked online, the statistics, they said less
than...
High. What do you think it is, Mr. Drew? We'll have two numbers. She said 25%.
5%? I think it's about 5%.
Wow, that's mighty big difference. Ms. Turner, are you counting, are you counting Asians? Are you kind of putting...
No, I'm not. There's the... We have the Africans, we have the Caribbeans. There's a lot of people... There's pockets in London, Ontario. There's a big, big portion of London that's black. So Mark says 5%. I would say about 25%. I've never actually even thought about looking at the breakdown of races in London. But back in the 20s, there was 5,000 blacks in London. Now, the 1920s, that was... Probably, the population in the 20s was lower than that, so.
About 50,000.
Right. Probably.
Okay. I looked online the demographics just to get an idea. I've never been to London. Yep. I have been to Ontario, but when I looked online the demographics, it said that it was more than 80% European. I took that to be white, which seems like it might be a little closer in line with Mr. Drew's numbers. And it says specifically, and it had individual breakdowns for different racial classifications, Asian, African, blah, blah, blah. And it went all through. It said for people of African descent, it was less than 3%. So that's a sizable difference, 25 to 5 or 25 to 3 out of a population.
Well, you know what, Gussie, if you also put in the total of the university and college students, there's a lot of, different cultures and creeds that come to London, Ontario, and also the private colleges as well, but especially University of Western Ontario and Saint John College. So that brings, there's a lot of different classes of, races that comes here to London, Ontario.
Interesting. We do any of our listeners that are north of the border in Canada? I know we have a lot of Toronto listeners. If you all, and we even have one of our listeners said he grew up in London. If you all would like to dial in and share your understanding of the demographics in your town, that would be great to get further input. Based on that, to me at least, it seemed in the film, it seemed like one of the main goals was to show that there have been black people in London, Ontario for a long time. 19th century black people were coming there from the States. Enslaved black people were coming there to make a better life for themselves, to establish where they could, get wealth, get jobs, live their lives without having to be enslaved or fear of being stolen back, where you've got the Fugitive Slave Act, eventually where they could be stolen back and taken back into enslavement, to show that, and then to show what a lot of these black people have done throughout the years living in London, Ontario, that you all had a lot of prominent black citizens who have accomplished a lot of great things, both locally within London and have ended up becoming, big stars on the Olympic team and that sort of thing. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yes,
absolutely.
It is.
Absolutely. Okay. I guess I'll go with Ms. Turner. I think you already mentioned it somewhat in your answer, where you were saying that you do deal with racism a little bit in the film. I think one of the reviews that you have on the website, it says that you all kind of touch racism gently in the project. It does come up. You all have kind of a news clip of Karen Reese. I guess even before I get to my question, you want to tell our listeners Karen Reese about her child?
We're talking about her son that passed away.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I actually worked with him. So what's your question again regarding her son?
Well, I have a different... I just wondered if you could give a little bit more background information about what happened to her son and how that relates to racism in London, Ontario.
from what I understand, guys, he was going out with a Caucasian girl, and they didn't feel that, you know, because of his skin color. And so he took his own life. And if this is what I'm trying to remember, because you're talking about the newspaper article?
Correct. There's a quick news clipping of what happened kind of briefly before you segue into a different aspect of the film. It's kind of towards the end of the film.
Right. Okay. Yes. And he took his own life because had to do with racism, of course. Mm. And it's unfortunate. He was a very nice person.
Was he being teased in any way because he's a black person? Was that happening at all at school or while he was growing up?
I never knew that about him, Gus. As I said, he and I worked together actually at a theater here in London. I was, you know, we call it the candy girls, were the ones that would give the popcorn out, and he was the usher to bring people to the theater, to their individual theaters. So, from what I understand, because I never knew that about him, that he had that was going on, because I just knew him working with him, and he was a really nice person, really nice guy. You know, the two that are nice, but he was a really nice guy, very cordial. And then when I heard about it, you know, and that article actually, because I gave Mark a bunch of newspaper articles, and I told Mark, just choose whatever you feel will work well with the film. And it's ironic that this gentleman I knew for a short period of time. So I can't really answer exactly what happened, because I don't really know. But I just know from what I read from the newspaper article. So.
Wow. It stood out to me. And again, it's one of those that was kind of quick in the film, because you all don't spend a lot of time on this.
You're right, yeah.
I saw it in the film, and number one, because we've been talking a lot about black mental health this year globally, with the major incidents that have been happening in Canada amongst the indigenous population. They just, I think within the last week or so, declared a state of emergency. They've had all of these suicides among young people, and we played some of the news clips on this program. I've heard repeatedly racism pop up, racism, white supremacy, them being teased as young people, them feeling that they don't feel that they don't fit in. These areas, these people have been deprived of resources for centuries, sounded to me like further evidence of my definition of racism, white supremacy, a deliberate effort to abuse and mistreat this population of non-white people there. But that was the second reason that it really stood out to me. Plus, I think we've heard quite a few other incidents. Just this seems to be a global aspect of racism where it just can really wear on your mental health and end up making a lot of non-white people self-destructive. When I saw this in conjunction with some of the other things that I mentioned about racism, it really was kind of dealt with in a very gentle manner in the film. It wasn't really very directly brought up. It was a lot more of just kind of focusing on, look at what some of these prominent black people have done in the London, Ontario area. Look at what they've accomplished and things that they've been involved in, community centers and that sort of thing. Look what they've been able to accomplish. To me, at times, it almost felt like an infomercial for how great London, Ontario is. Like, this is a great place to live. This is a great place to be. This is a beautiful city, and black people have done a lot of great things here. You should come visit, or you should come to London, Ontario. That was kind of what it felt like at times. And I had a hard time matching it up. Like, well, wait a minute. Racism is still a pretty big problem. And it just seemed like that kind of got short shrift in the film. Would you all like to respond to that?
Sure. I'll respond, I guess. We didn't focus heavily on racism. I think, you know, Justine and I both would agree that there's a stigma, I think, with a lot of quote-unquote black culture and black history film-related things, documentaries, and so that focus a lot on the negativity that's connected with the black culture. And one of the things we wanted to do with this film was also point out there's a lot of positivity that comes out of that community as well, which is why, you know, when you deal with this perception, whether or not our perception is correct or not, it is a perception that a lot of the black communities and a lot of black culture is viewed negatively. I think you would probably agree with that, you know, in a very general way. We made this film really as a counter argument to that point, to say, you know, yes, there is negativity that is attached with it, and yes, there's racism, but, you know, let's take a moment here to celebrate all of the good things that these people have done and how much they have contributed. And, you know, I can understand the critique, I guess, that it seems like an infomercial sometimes. I think maybe that comes from just a fact that there is, these positive messages aren't as widespread as the negative ones, and that's why it may have seemed in a way almost over the top and, you know, intentionally trying to be positive and ignore things. But it was really, you know, we constructed the film based on what people told us in the interviews. We didn't have scripts or anything. So that is those people telling us those things, and we put it together in a way to show this is the way people see their own lives and accomplishments in this city and the way they see the city. So if it comes off as looking hokey, I mean, I guess that's because everyone here is.
Mr. Turner, it's your line went out a little bit. You said if it comes off as.
Yeah, I'm here now. Yeah, it's coming. I'm here now. Mark cut out.
That was my fault. I didn't mean Ms. Turner. I meant Mr. Drew. Your line, yeah, cut out a little bit when you said if it comes across as a little hokey, that's because everyone here, and then it went out.
Oh, I said, I guess, you know, people love, you know, a lot of people love where they live, so they don't want to think negatively about it, so they will focus more on the positives
in a
situation where they feel comfortable.
Got it. Ms. Turner, Justine Turner, did you want to respond to the same question in terms of it didn't really seem like you all gave too much focus to racism as a current and major problem in London, Ontario?
You know, I'm going to tell you something. That's when I'd call people and I'd ask them, tell them, you know, I'm doing this film to concentrate on Black history here in London, Ontario. And I'd ask them if they'd like to be on the film. And they said, yes, absolutely. And once we get there, they would ask me, what do we talk about? I said, we don't talk about anything. I said, you know, we're just going to talk about your life. It's all improv. So I didn't say, okay, this is a focal point. Here's a script. Here's the topics. It was just like, and they talked. So what you see in the film, you know, it's not about, you know, hey, London, Ontario is a great place to live in. Yeah, it is, but that's not the point, though. What you see in the film is what you see, and that's a real McCoy. And so to answer your question, it was all improv. No script, nothing, and they just talked. And, you know, the film wasn't about me. I was very blessed to have that thought come to my mind and make it into a plan and an action. And here we are today. So these people that were on the film, including my father, even though, you know, he is my father, but let me tell you something. I got to tell him, like, you know, don't say this, don't say that. But I didn't tell him that. I said, no, this is what we're going to talk about, Daddy. You know, we're going to talk about Black history. Just talk. And we met at my parents' house, and he spoke. So, and that's a man that will just say it like it is. And these people spoke from the heart. And again, it was no script, and they were very, very comfortable being there. It's like we were just having a cup of coffee, or like at a coffee shop or what have you, or in their living room, dining room. It was just a really nice conversation, and thus the film was created, and it came to life.
Context of white supremacy. Again, the filmmakers for Finding Freedom in the Forest City. Filmmakers Mark Drew, Justine Turner, great to have them on the program, joining us live from Canada. That article, make sure I get correct myself, it is not Kathleen Reese, it is Karen Reese. And the article that you all held up, I couldn't find it online, but the snippet that you all have in the film, London Still a Hotbed of Racism and Prejudice, and the subtitle reads, Karen Reese's son couldn't take the cruel hurt from racists at school and later committed suicide, where it did seem like he was getting some racist abuse directly from school, which we've heard a lot of stateside as well. I guess before I get to some of the folks that called in who have questions, even something like that that gets such a quick take, from my perspective, it's great. I can understand the logic in saying, because I suspect both of you would agree in saying that a lot of people probably do not know the long history of black Londoners in the Ontario area, and how long black people have been a presence there and contributed, and how you've had black people who ended up being wealthy business owners who made a lot of money, who were not down and out criminals and what have you, who were doing very well, have continued to do so, that a lot of people probably don't know that history, probably are not aware of how long black people have been contributing, proud members of London, Ontario. I can see like the logic, the value, and why you'd want to do that. But just when you have stories like this, I suspect this is also something that probably doesn't get that much attention. I think this, at least in my view, this would deserve equal footing, where we're addressing this not in such a, how would I say, Pollyanna fashion, making it seem kind of downplaying the major problem that white supremacy continues to be, where young children are dying because of just being abused by racists at school and what have you. That sort of thing, I think, often gets greatly minimized, where we're not really talking about that. And I was reminded just... I don't even think most of our listeners saw the film. I just said we have filmmakers coming on. They're doing a documentary project on London, Ontario, and racism in that area, history of black people, black history in that area. And they just started sending all these reports. I didn't even know we had listeners who were in the London, Ontario area. And we had a person who wrote in who talked about how some of his experiences growing up in that area and what he experienced, what his family experienced. He shared some articles. It's a great report that was on Vice this year. I just read a tad from it. The article is "London, Ontario Was a Racist Asshole to Me." Now, this was published in May of 2015. Just the little portion that I'll read from it. It says, "London is an old white man in a Klan hat. Ironically, there was a time when London was considered one of the more accepting cities of black settlers. By the 1850s, London was an active little city that was home to some of the richest black settlers in Ontario, many of whom had come through the Underground Railroad as refugee slaves. But ex-slave Dr. Alfred T. Jones said that in London, there was a mean prejudice that couldn't be found in the States. By 1863, segregated schools were in the works, but a lack of funding crushed the dream. Ola Osman, I hope I'm saying the name correctly, now a student at Western, tells me about growing up in London's school system. In grade 7, she asked her white teacher why they weren't talking about black history. His answer was, because it's not important, she tells me. A few days later, the same teacher put together a slideshow of brutalized slaves. A slide came up of a black man being lynched, Osman says. My teacher pointed at the picture and said, this is a nigger. I will stop there. It goes on to give a lot of more incidents, and I mean things that have happened within the last 2, 3, 4 years just in London, Ontario. And kind of that's why I was saying I feel like this is the sort of thing that deserves equal footing, to make sure that people are not just, I think sometimes people get caught up in a congratulatory, hey, we're doing great, we're about diversity, look at these black people doing great things, and not, oh wow, white supremacy is a major problem that we should be focused on and trying to do better about. Responses?
I guess, yeah, there's definitely a systemic problem. I mean, from some of the research I did and have continued to do about the origins of black history in the city, and you're absolutely right to say that blacks essentially have been in London since London has been formed. The research I found that they showed up about 10 years after London was founded. So they've been here pretty much as long as the original white settlers have as well. And there has been racism, for sure. And I think that racism, you know, has always been pushed or swept under the rug in London and probably in Canada in general. I don't think that it's specific to London that this type of racist activities happen in Canada. I would say it probably happens in many places in Canada. London may just be a bit more of a hotbed for it, right? Because it does have more of an established black community, and a lot of the established white supremacist community, I guess would be a way to say it, would use this area as a hotbed, right, to spread the messages of hate and discrimination and racism, because there is that community that exists here, whereas in other communities, maybe in Canada, I'm speaking specifically here, you know, if you're going to northern Manitoba or you know, way into the bush and way into the north, you probably don't see those established communities as much, and you probably see only white people dealing with white people. So I'd say, you know, agreed, it is an issue. I think it continues to be an issue today. I think the biggest problem, apart from the acts of racism themselves, you know, that's the biggest problem. But the secondary biggest problem that comes with it is, I guess, a complacency towards that. And, you know, although the film does not touch too much on it, the strange thing that we found was that people came to us after watching the film and they were overwhelmed with the positivity of the message. And some of people came up to us and said they were actually refreshed with the positivity because they were expecting a negative film about Black history. And I guess that goes back to what I was saying about these stigmas and the negative connotations and stereotypes that already pre-exist. So yes, definitely a problem. We didn't go too much in depth with it because it's a told story in many ways, and we wanted to do the opposite of that, and that's what shocked people. But I guess the biggest problem with racism in London, apart from the acts itself, is the fact that you're right, people don't talk about it. They don't want to talk about it, but it's an uncomfortable subject, and London, I guess, has a reputation. I assume outside of London, people think they're all white. I think within London, they like to think they're multicultural, but there's been a history here of racism since the beginning. You were right about the integrated schools. I mean, that's something I've researched as well, and they fell apart for different reasons, but racism was the chief reason that they fell apart. And it continues to this day, but I think racism now, when you think of white supremacy, nobody would openly admit they're a white supremacist like they may have 50, 100 years ago. And that's almost worse in a way because now they hide it. And now the acts that happen are, you know, actively tried to kept out of, and they're more specific to a certain person or a certain race. And it's a problem, you know, finding those types of people. They may not be many, but one is too many as far as I'm concerned.
Mm. Anything you want to add, Ms. Turner, before we get some of our callers?
You know, your question regarding give me that question again, please.
Yes, ma'am. In my view, the film, I see the logic in terms of what you all put forward, but the report that I read from Vice, where this young lady journalist was talking about her experience in Ontario with racism, both giving some of the history of it and current 2016 incidents of racism, white supremacy that she and many other black Londoners were experiencing, and that not being addressed. Even I think one of our callers in Canada, he says consistently that he thinks that's one of the biggest problems, that people think of Canada as this haven. It's not racist. Great. This is a safe haven where black people can get away from the bad racist boogeyman in the United States, and in your film, you are not addressing racism. It kind of plays into that to some degree. Did you want to respond?
Again, I guess everybody that was on the film, they talk from the heart. So if they want to talk racism, they have the platform for that. So London is, you know what, in any city, urban city, it's tough. But they made it. So, you know, I mean, I had racism as a child. And Zebra was the common name. But this film is about lives, that people's lives, and they made what they made here in the city of London. And, you know, I can say, okay, is London a racist city? There's racism here, of course there is, but people overcame that, and I know with me, I overcame it, and here I am. You know, I have a sibling who owns his own business, and, you know, he's doing what he has to do. So, this film is about people's lives and what they did, how they did it, you know, how they came here, if they're immigrants, it's and they showed it with everything in their being on the film. The film's a beautiful film. It's about love.
Context of white supremacy. Again, Ms. Justine Turner, Mark Drew, will hit the phone lines if folks have any questions they would like to ask. If you want to get more information, you can read some of the reviews. You can see trailers, little snippets from the film. You can see Ms. Justine Turner's father, a portion of his segment from the film. The website, findingfreedominTheForestCity.com. It's linked, if that's too much for you to type in, it's linked in the description for the program. You can just click it and it'll take you right to the page. And again, you'll see more information. You can even send her an email, or if you are so inclined. Again, as I said, we have listeners who grew up in the London, Ontario area. He wrote in, he said, I know you all are going to do a show about this tomorrow, and I thought this information could be helpful. It's been my experience that black people in London are highly victimized, as I was living in that environment. I'm not sure how informed your guest will be, but I suspect from her picture she may be more confused and probably passes for white in many situations in her daily life. He goes on to say, I can tell you from my personal experience that this area has a historical and presently is a hotbed for very codified racist behavior in all areas of people activity. But what is particularly unique to this area is that at least three of the largest white supremacist and or skinhead groups in Canada make London, Ontario, and the surrounding area their home and headquarters. The Northern Alliance Canada is just one of them, and they have, I guess, their own website. In my opinion, that sort of thing should be, you know, included in this sort of documentary, but you can have a different opinion there, certainly. The person that dialed in, I'll try to privilege our folks that are calling in from Toronto to get them first. Caller dialing in from Canada, Toronto, I believe. Did you have a question for our filmmakers, Mr. Drew, Ms. Turner?
Wait, Gus, you're going to have to get back to me. I'm just sort of clearing my mind. You're going to have to get back to me.
Not a problem. Not a problem. Let me see how cool I am at picking out other Canadian callers. See, a caller on the vote line. Did you have any questions? First, are you calling in from Canada?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes, I am in Canada.
Wonderful.
I am in Atlantic Canada. I have spent some time in London briefly. There's so much confusion. But the host of the show, I got to say that you're definitely not confused. It's strange to me that you would do a, that we would have a documentary about black history in a white supremacist country like Canada, and not really talk about the experiences of white supremacy and racism. And also strange to me that someone who is not suffering from a medical condition that causes them not to see color would say that they're colorblind. Those are really fundamentally confusing things for, you know. And something else that I will add is that one thing that people who are white or who pass as white often don't realize is that it is usually relatively hostile when black people tell the truth about their lives. And so if we're interviewing someone and it's not made clear that it's a safe environment, you might hear what people think you want to hear, and not necessarily what the other parts of the story that they might want to share. Is that making any sense? Hello?
Your line isn't the clearest. I think I was able to make out. I guess I'll repeat it back, and if you can let me know, but I don't know if it's if you're on speakerphone or if you're too close, but it's not quite the clearest. The last part of it where you were saying, I know you said there's lots of confusion. I think the last part where you said if you're interviewing someone, they might tell you what you want to hear, as opposed to getting, okay, I definitely got that part, as opposed to getting to more sensitive subjects, I didn't hear a question. I think you made a comment about passing as white. Did you touch on that as well? Are you still with us, the caller on the vote line? Are you still there? Okay, I'm not hearing it at all. I know I heard a comment about passing as white, but it was not a question.
Mm-hmm.
The portion that I heard most clear, I think he said either the host is more confused or less confused. I couldn't quite make that part out either. But the last part where he said about if you're doing an interview with someone where they might not talk about things that are more painful, more sensitive subject matters, and that might be something that you, as the person conducting the interview, might have to be aware of and make an effort, I guess, to navigate or ask questions or be a bit more probing to get at those things. If the person that you're interviewing, the subject, if they are not going there, if they're just kind of being casual and they just want to talk about things that are comfortable and pleasant and are going to be easy and not going to upset anyone. Did you want to respond to that?
We did prompt people in the interview. Yeah, sorry, if you want to go ahead, Justine, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Mark, go ahead.
Oh, I was saying, like, you know, we did prompt people in the interviews if they experienced any racism or any kind of prejudice. You know, some people shared some kind of isolated stories here and there, you know, and a lot of people, you know, said yes, but they didn't want to talk about it, or, you know, it wasn't something that they really wanted to get into too much. So, you know, we can only probe so much in terms of what we were asking. I mean, we did get a few stories from certain interviewed couples and certain interviewed people that we had on in the film that did share stories where they experienced racism or a form of racism. But in large part, you know, people weren't so much interested in telling us those aspects of their lives as they were trying to tell the aspects of their lives that they were proud of or that they felt, you know, represented an accomplishment they made themselves, as opposed to someone imposing something on them that they had to overcome. I guess if that kind of makes it contextualized, I mean, over the course of 40 interviews, we definitely had people tell us about racism. But for the most part, they wanted to focus on positivity over the negativity. So we just took what we were given.
Okay. Justine, were you going to respond to that as well?
First, I was trying to figure out what Jim was saying, but thank you for interpreting what he said, Gus. But, you know, regarding he said about the host, and then he said posing as someone and using a platform. I'm trying to, because I want to answer this question, you know, thoroughly. So, in regards to what he said, you know, first of all, I'm not using the platform for anything. I use this platform because I am so proud of the fact that I had the knowledge to have this inspiration of this film and in posing as someone. And, you know, I think I believe he said something about beyond the surface or something like that. You know, I'm right there. So when it comes to any question. So, in regards to what Mark just said, racism was talked about, but it really wasn't, to tell you the truth. It was asked, but it really wasn't talked about. The footage we have is amazing. The raw footage. I mean, you see what you see, but Mark sent you a film, but people were just there to talk about what happened in their lives. So, yeah. You know, it's a real film.
It's hard. It's just really hard to, like, contextualize, you know. If somebody doesn't want to talk about racism they experienced, it's hard for us to probe more and make them more uncomfortable about it, when that's not necessarily the focus we were going for. I mean, I think we had the opportunity to make a film that focused only on the racism and the racist aspects and white supremacy. I mean, we could have done it, honestly. There was enough that we could have focused only on that. We just chose to focus on something other than that, I suppose.
Fascinating. The caller on the vote line, if you had a question, just one quick, concise question before we move on, because I want to try to get as many of our callers as we can. Did you have one quick question, if you're any clearer, that you can get through?
Yes. Am I coming through clear?
That's a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the comments last question was that when people are being interviewed by someone that appears to be white, it is very important for people to make it clear that it is okay and it is safe to talk about these issues, especially issues of race. Especially because if someone's refusing to talk about whiteness or to refusing to identify or to even acknowledge that whiteness and white supremacy and racism and how that is universal, and responded in such a negative manner to the host, it would be, I would sense that someone who actually wants to talk about these issues may not feel comfortable speaking with you about those things. So it's important to be conscious about that as we interview, so that we actually can also get the other part about it, not just the comfortable truth that we want to hear. I forgot what you did the thing about the inconvenient truth. There's an inconvenient truth of white supremacy and racism in London, Ontario.
Got it.
I guess technically that wasn't a question.
But right.
I thank you for your time.
Right. I think that you all did kind of respond to that already in saying that you did get more, I guess, information on racism, and you chose not to go that way, and you did probe people to talk about racism, but they, I guess, only wanted to talk about things that were comfortable. Did you all want to add anything more to his comment?
I would kind of agree. Sorry, go ahead, Jesse. Go ahead.
Sat with these people, they would say, okay, this is, obviously they knew what we're going to be talking about. And then, we'd arrive, myself and Mark, and Mark would get his camera set up, and we'd find us, a room or wherever we are, in their home or their office or what have you. And then they would just talk. And I would say, like I said, they'd ask me, what were we talking about? Of course, they already knew why they were coming there. And they just talk from their heart. And I know I keep repeating myself, but that is truly, that's what, a beautiful conversation. And we didn't tell them, talk about this, talk about that. I'd always would motion to Mark, who obviously was behind the camera, Mark, do you have any questions? Because obviously Mark and I were partners. I'm directing the film, but he's, obviously with me that way as well as a filmmaker, and he'd ask certain questions that I may not have thought of, but we didn't have to even ask questions pretty much 80% of the time. So they talked what they felt that they had to talk about. Go ahead, Mark, what do you have to say?
I'm going back through my mind through that comment, and he's saying how sometimes if it's white or people that appear to be white interviewing black people, that they may say something different or act a different way. In our film, a lot of the times either Justine knew them personally through her family or through the community that her family was connected to, or we were recommended to these people. So, we never really went in cold, with the exception of maybe one or two interviews. But for the most part, people knew who the Justine, the host, was. They knew who I was as a filmmaker. So we were a little bit lucky, I guess, in the sense that we didn't really have that barrier right away as who are these two white people asking questions about black history. It was, more of, this is Justine, I grew up with her, or, I know her dad, or something like that. So we just walked in as almost like members of that family or members of their friend group from the beginning. So a lot of people didn't give us that barrier right away. And I guess we were very fortunate in that sense.
Hang on. Check in with our Toronto caller, see if he has his mind clear. I'm going to ask if people can just do questions. That way we can roll through and try to get as many of our callers as possible. Toronto caller, did you have a question for Mr. Drew, Ms. Turner?
Well, I kind of had a statement more than a question. Is that okay? I'll try to be concise.
I guess.
Okay. I just want to say one thing about the question of focus, what you guys focused on the film. I haven't seen it. But I was going to say that with London Black History, you can do both, because you can't describe the black presence in London without looking at the issue of racism, without looking at, because even multiculturalism itself is a direct product of imperialism. Like, we're only here because our countries, black countries and non-white countries, are systematically exploited by Western white powers. So I think racism has to be discussed alongside it, or it doesn't make sense. I think you can do both. And I guess it's just a question of how to get people to interview, I would say, in the future. And the other thing I found problematic is this emphasis on color blindness. And I think, because I understand where Justina's coming from, you know, people who think I'm white, but I have this sort of ancestry, and, you know, people are ignoring this. One thing you got to understand about racism, it's a system, right? And people are going to treat you a certain way when they see how you look and whatever issues there are. Color blindness does not help. And I'm one of those calls, I frequently tell Gus this. This is part of what creates racism. It's not the problem that I'm black or that you look white. It's the problem that a system demonizes me because I'm black. And this is exactly the problem that creates and amplifies the confusion that black people have in Canada. When you talk in colorblind ways, when the society does not treat them like that. And I'll just look at Prince for an example. The artist Prince, you know, he has no color. Prince is very clear about being black. He even recently made a comment about how the music industry is exactly like plantation enslavement. So I was going to ask, and this is going to lead into my question. I just think those are things you should think about. Colorblindness isn't going to help. It just makes the problem worse. And now for my question.
I do want to state, because people are going to do a lot of this, and we do have a lot of callers. You said you didn't have a question. You just had a comment.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
I guess
don't think we're going to repeat that. Questions only. We do not have time for speechifying today. He just tricked me because he said he didn't have a question. He just had a comment.
Sorry.
Let's get your question, sir.
Sorry. No, it's okay. Sorry. I should stick to what I said. I guess my mind's out of place. Sorry.
Let's hear your question.
Do you think it's possible that white people do not want to talk about racism simply because they're comfortable with being on top?
Being on top?
Yeah.
Hi, social hierarchy wise, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Go ahead, Mark. Do you want to answer my question?
Yes, I agree. I totally agree.
I agree as well.
That was concise. Right on. Before I hit our next caller, I guess specifically to Justine, since that issue came up, did you want to respond to his statement about the colorblindness, quote unquote, how that contributes to white supremacy?
Yeah, he also focused on black history and first of all, the film is focused, he mentioned that we should talk about racism. I understand where he's coming from. I truly understand that. But the film was focusing on black history. And that the film took its own life, okay? So regarding racism, if that was going to come up, it was going to come up. But that wasn't the focal point. Regarding being colorblind, as I mentioned, I didn't know any color. Of course, growing up, you realize right away, you know, at least about 5 or 6, okay, you know, something going on here. But I thank God that, you know, it's a great thing that I was blessed to be a product of my parents. Because I was colorblind. I still am. because I don't look at my father as black. I don't look at my mother as white. That's my mother. That's my father. So, and therefore, I can have a voice and I can be very strong in talking to people because, yeah, things I have endured in my life from the Caucasians, from the blacks, from all different colors and cultures. And you mentioned about Prince, and I said Prince is colorblind. Like and I believe he always was because I grew up with Prince in the 80s. And he was, you know, he's Prince. And I didn't, you know, I didn't realize like, what this gentleman was just saying about Prince, but he was talking about how it would be, I think he was talking about the record company or something like that. But anyway, nevertheless, this is my comment to this gentleman's question.
Right on. Thomas in New York, we'll pick up other Canadians as we roll, I suspect. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Justine and Mark?
Yes, I have a few very quick questions, and hopefully I can get quick answers because I'm pretty confused. So I'm going to go to the person on the line who's not confused, the gentleman. First, sir, I would like to ask you, if you were, Gus, first for you, is that a picture on your Facebook?
That is Ms. Turner, yes, sir.
Oh, okay. So to the gentleman, do you consider her to be white or black, based off if you first saw her?
Me?
Yes.
You're asking me?
Yes, you're white.
Well,
right?
When we first talked, yes, I would consider myself white.
Okay.
Yeah, when we first met, it was on the phone. So, you know, she told me she was biracial before we met. So I didn't really have that initial white or black experience when I went and met her. I mean, she had already told me. So I guess it kind of nullified my own, you know, if I saw Justine on the street, I mean, based purely on skin tone, she would appear white. But, you know, after talking to her for about 15 to 20 seconds, you understand that she's not just white. She's both. I mean, I think Justine is very proud of that fact, which she's pointed out. And I guess, you know, first impressions can be wrong easily. So does it... In a way, does it matter if she appears white or if she is black? I mean, she is who she is, like she said. And that's the way I went into it was, who is this person, not anything other than that.
Oh, okay. Now, you guys are not in a relationship, not in a romantic relationship?
No, not at all.
Okay. Are you in a romantic relationship with a black female yourself?
Have I personally done it? I'm dated, but never done anything seriously, I guess.
Okay. Now, this question's for the lady. Well, based off your picture, do you color your hair at all?
Yes, I did.
And do you also have to, like, straighten your hair a little?
Yes, I did.
So you were trying to pass off as a white person?
No, I was not. I was just doing it because it's the style I wanted.
Okay. Do you often go
places? Can you send me your picture? What you look like?
No, sure. If you want it, sure. But generally, when you go places, do you people automatically assume that you are white? Do they ever talk to you in the ways about black people, and you might have to correct them?
Well, when I go places, I don't, you know, that topic doesn't come up. Depending, of course, you know, of what I'm doing at the time, right? So, if it does come up, majority of times they think I'm Caucasian, and I let them know that I'm mulatta.
A mulatta. Is that a classification in Canada? Like, do you guys get on your license? In America, we
check
black or white or Hispanic on our license when we go to get a driver's license or a state ID. Do you guys do that in Canada?
No, we have female or male.
Oh, that's yeah, all. Okay, okay. Wow, that's interesting.
That's interesting. So you guys have the okay. Yeah. Now my driver's license doesn't have my color of what I am, my who I am. So it just says female. Yeah.
Okay. Now
that's really sad. That's really sad that that's actually happening there. Go ahead. Uh huh.
Well, before I get to my last question, are you involved in a relationship with a black or a white male or female?
Well, first of all, I don't think that's any of your business. But no, I'm not in any relationship right now.
So, do you prefer black men or white men?
Again, that's not any of your business. So, it has nothing to do with their color. If that person is a gentleman, that you know,
you do recognize the difference between the two.
I beg your pardon?
I say you do recognize there's a difference between the two, right?
Yes, I do. I'm colorblind. I am colorblind. When I was growing up as a child, I'm colorblind. I'm still colorblind because, my past relationship, the person has nothing to do with their color. It has to do with who they are inside. You know, I'm going to tell you something. The bottom line is this. We can talk and talk and get all these callers coming in and talk and dissect and everything. The bottom line is this. We're all one. Okay? We're all one. And I'm going to ask you a question. I beg your pardon?
What did you say? We're all white? You said we're all white?
I said we're all one. One. O-N-E.
We're all
O-N-E.
Like we're
one.
The same, you're saying.
We are all one. Okay?
No, I asked if we're all treated like we're the same. Are we all treated like we are the same on this planet?
No, we're not. It's unfortunate we're not.
Okay.
But we are all one. We are.
Well, my last question
we really
is,
are.
Do you think that you would have been as defensive with the host if the host was white? And I'll mute my line on that.
No, not at all. The host just asked me a question, and I respond to the question. It has nothing to do with. And then you know what? As a matter of fact, I don't know if Gus is black. I don't know what his skin color is. I never even asked him that. I talked to him last week. Even I talked to the founder of Black Network 2 weeks ago, Scotty Reed. Never asked him what Gus's race was. Okay, so this gentleman could be. Asian, you know, you could be an alien. You never know, right? If you believe in that. So, moving on. Next question.
Right on. E.T. Color in Michigan, not that far. Michigan, I said Detroit in Toronto. London is about halfway in between Detroit and Toronto. Caller in Michigan, did you have a question for Justine Turner? Mark Drew.
Good evening. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Very interesting conversation this evening. I do have three questions I will get to quickly. The first question is to Ms. Turner. Earlier you said that you overcame racism, and you also mentioned your brother overcame racism. Can you give examples of how you overcame racism?
Yes, I mentioned about my brother who owns his own business, and he does a great job with that. How about overcame racism? I grew up in the 70s, so I was born in 1969. So, I mean, as a child, I was like, in the 70s, you elementary school. And back in the day, for the lack of a better phrase, the name was Zebra, and I was called that many times. And I would come home in tears and, tell my parents about this. And they always made sure that they looked after everything. Now I'm going to segue a little bit. When I say they looked after everything, they did. Because my parents were the people that just didn't just listen, which they did. But they took it on hands-on. And back then, you could. Well, I should say they could. And they would go into schools and make sure that these kids would were reprimanded as to what they said to me and what they did. I mean, even to this day, I have things that, you know, you have people look at you a certain way, like, oh, okay, well, why are you doing Black History? I started Black History in London in 1991. And people that don't know me, like, well, why are you doing this? And I explain, like, well, my, you know, my grandmother and I, you know, I was born, you know, into this beautiful family. And as a child, you know, they don't realize that I should just have this, like, billboard saying, you know, Justine Turner was 2 years old, a little missionary at Bethany Church, and, you know, brought to these missionary meetings every last Thursday of month, every month, with all these beautiful women, and, you know, having these meetings. And I had a beautiful foundation set before me to do, to obviously that God wanted me to do. And I, you know, my grandmother, my father's mother, was almost the same color as me, and she had major racism. But I had so much leaders in my life that made me feel and helped me to propel me where I am and overcome things. And I didn't, you know, I don't really look at that anymore, nor do I even really look at it at that time. It hurt, overcame it, move on. With all due respect, the United States, I know there's a lot of racism there. I know that for a fact. But it's too bad. Canada, it's not like that in that sense. So, go ahead.
I didn't mean to cut you off, but I do have a couple more questions. But just in response to your answer, so would you suggest, I mean, I do own my own business, but would you suggest individuals who have not overcome racism to move to Canada to not be mistreated? Would that be like a suggestion, since you said that, I guess, you know, I'm interpreting it as it, as if it doesn't really exist in your city?
You know what? Move to Canada if you... Go ahead, Mark. You can move to Canada if you like.
It exists in London.
So would owning a business help me? I own a business, and I have definitely not overcome. My definition of overcoming is defeating it. So I'm just trying to get a better understanding, and I do have two other questions.
Okay, so regarding you saying owning a business, you know what? Bottom line is this. If your business is surviving where you are, you know, make it happen. And Canada, you know, I guess I was saying to you, the racism is not as prominent as it is in the United States. So I'm not saying to you, move to Canada. But if you want to move to Canada, that's up to you. That's your choice. But all the best with your business.
All right, my second question is for the both of you. Who do you feel is most confused about racism, white supremacy, white people or non-white people, and why? And this is for both of you to answer.
What's your question again? Can you repeat that, please?
Sure. Who do you feel is most confused about racism, white supremacy, white people or non-white people, and why?
Who is most confused about
racism, white supremacy?
Do you mean like in modern day, or do you mean like historically speaking?
In general, today, especially with the people you know, just in general, who do you feel is most confused? Especially, I mean, you guys did a film and you interact with people daily, I'm sure, black people and non-white people. Mm-hmm. So... Who do you feel is most confused?
It
depends on the person.
White people? But yeah, that's what I would say. I mean...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
you. I guess... Oh, I said, you know, it's probably white people, but it's really person to person here, as opposed to, you know, maybe it's somewhat different in the States, but in Canada, right, like, racism isn't so much white versus
black. It's, you know, any ignorant person versus their beliefs against somebody that doesn't have that type of belief structure. It's much more convoluted here. It's not straightforward. Like, the narrative right in the States is very obvious. Slavery, civil war, emancipation, those type of things, right, are very forefront in American culture. In Canada, it's relationship with racism. First of all, like, officially, Canada would probably try to just pretend it never happened. But I would say, like, the biggest racism that Canada has isn't so much white versus black. I guess it would be more like the administrative white, for lack of a term, like government white or whatever you would want to call it, against Aboriginals more so is the obvious injustice, I would say, that's forefront here, is the relationship with Aboriginals to the whites more so than black and white. So it's very, very convoluted here in terms of what is racism and what's considered racism.
So just so I'm clear, because I'm not really clear on the answer, and in general, you're saying that white people, for the most part, is more confused about racism? Just in general,
some
your experience. Okay, and Ms. Turner, what is your experience? Is it more white people or non-white?
Yeah, it's individual, person to person. That's confused, because they, you know, you can, being the fact that I am, of course, can address it from a different perspective from Mark, you know, they are confused as to what's going on, whether it's black person or white person.
Who's
and how they want
to
address
you. I'm sorry. I'm just not clear. Who are the they?
I say they. They being white, they being black, they being Asian, they being East Indian, they being Aboriginal, you know, they being Puerto Rican. It's all to do with, you know, the platform and what you're talking about with the person. So it's individual.
Yeah, I mean, because there's a lot of whites here that know a lot about racism and multiculturalism, those type of things. And then you could walk 20 meters down the street or 20 feet down the street and talk to a white person that is the exact opposite, knows very little about these things, is ignorant and, you know, somewhat bigoted, maybe not overtly so, but they say comments here and there that you're like, oh, you know, that's, you know, in your mind, you're like, yeah, that's racist. But it's not at the forefront, not in the same way. But it's very individual.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that. And my last question is to Ms. Turner. You use the term colorblind quite frequently throughout the conversation, and I guess I'm just not clear. What is your definition of colorblind? Like, what do you mean by that? Because you said that... You said specifically you don't look at your father as black, so how are
no,
you
I don't.
Like, teach me how to be colorblind. Like, I want to be colorblind. So how would you
if you were raised in my family, I can teach you. Let me know when you're done. Are you done?
I'm done, yeah.
Okay. I can teach you to be colorblind if you were raised in my family. That's how I can teach you. Because I don't look at my father as black or mother as white. That's my father. That's my mother. So I'm colorblind when it comes to that. Because of my brothers, I'm colorblind. Because of my nephews, I'm colorblind. Okay? Because that's...
But what does that mean? I just want you... Like, what does... Can you give me a definition?
I'll tell you what that means. I don't look at them as... I don't look at them as a certain color. Like, so I don't look at my father. He's a black man. Yes, he is a black man. But I don't look at him as a black man. I don't look at my mother as a... She's a white lady. She's not a white lady. She's my mom. You know, don't look at my brothers like, okay, well, you know, we're half black, half white. We're just who we are. Of course
okay,
we are.
Because
we're
natural
appearance.
Okay, sorry to interrupt. Just in general, how do you look at President Obama? Is he a black man, white man? Do you see color when you see him, or... What do you see?
I look at him look at him as the chief and commander. I look at him as he's the president of the United States. I don't look at him as a black man. I don't look at him as like he's the president of the United States. I mean,
okay.
Obviously, he if as a person looking at him, he's obviously he has tan. He's tan skin. Okay, he's a brown skinned man, but I don't look at him as a black man. I look at him he's just, you know, the president of the United States. Of course, I already know, you know, his mother is Caucasian, his father is black. But, you know, if you want to ask me a question, what I think who he is, he's a mulatto man. But he is, I just look at President Obama as President Obama, period.
Okay. All right. Thanks for answering my questions. thanks for taking my call, and I am going on mute.
For sure. Caller at 3358, 3358. Did you have a question for Justine? Mark, you should be with us.
Greetings, everyone.
Greetings.
My first question is to the lady, Ms. Turner. Mm-hmm. You study African history, or let's say you practice black history.
I coordinate a Black History celebration here in London, Ontario.
Okay.
Yes, I right. study.
So you coordinate a Black History, and okay. You're colorblind. You said that,
yeah.
Correct?
That's right.
Do you think that's being accurate when you're
absolutely
colorblind?
Accurate.
How do you know that you're doing Black History if you're colorblind?
Okay. You know what? Let's kind of, you know, I say colorblind, right? I am colorblind,
mm-hmm.
because I am who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I also know, I'm also well aware of my mother's ancestry and my father's ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
And because, okay. thank God, I've had the great induction to so much history in my life as a young, young child, I created something in the city that people need to know.
Okay.
And let me tell you something
now,
else. Go ahead.
Okay.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. And now, with that said, when you're saying you're colorblind, what confuses me is mm-hmm. that you go through the trouble of doing this black thing, but you're colorblind.
I don't go through no troubles. There's no troubles. There's no troubles watching that.
That doesn't make it's confusing me. It's what it is. It's confusing me. Why would you go through the trouble if you're colorblind? And if the society around you was colorblind, is the society around you colorblind,
mm-hmm.
or is it just you're just being colorblind or ignoring the issue?
First of all, I am colorblind.
If I can just jump in,
okay?
Justine, if I can just jump in for a sec. I think okay. there's a bit of a confusion, I think, from some of the callers. I think, you know, when Justine, you're talking about being called.
You're breaking up, sir. I can't hear you.
Yeah.
Say that again, please.
Yeah, didn't hear you at all there, Mark.
Colorblind. You're talking about the way
we didn't hear
judge.
You.
Okay, there we are.
Yeah, we weren't able to hear you for a second there, Mark. So if you could, you know, start
colorblind.
Your response. If you could start your response.
I don't think Mark can hear that.
Yeah, Mark, are you?
Did we lose him?
Mark, are you with us? It just sounded like his line was breaking up.
I think when Justine talks about being.
Mark, are you? This happened, I think, before where his line, it seemed like, was going in and out for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Are you there, Mark?
Mark, you there?
I'm there. Can you hear me okay?
Okay. No, we couldn't hear you at all. We couldn't hear any of your response. If you could kind of give it to us again about the colorblind, where you were going to interject, because we couldn't hear you at all. Oh, and it sounds like he's gone again. What in the world?
Wow.
Mark, are you there?
Yeah, no problem. Sorry.
Mark, you there?
Oh, wow. I really want to hear what he's got to say there.
That is not. And the crazy thing is, he's on.
Colorblind.
You still on the line, Gus?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me, Justine?
I can, but I just asked you, do you still have Mark on the line?
Oh, yes, ma'am. He's showing. I've got him right here on my board. I have both of. I was just going to tell our callers that I. Oh, now he looks like he dropped. Now I don't have him. Okay. I will call him back. I don't know if maybe he's got a bad signal or something like that. I'll try to add him back and see if he's clearer. Colorblind. Getting his response, he was interjecting on colorblind just to kind of keep folks in pace with where we are.
Hello?
All right. Mr. Drew, can you hear us okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine the whole time. I guess you guys just couldn't hear me.
No, we could not. It's something, like what happened before where your line was just breaking up a little bit. If you want to give us your response again, where you were interjecting about colorblind.
Yeah, no problem. I said, the listeners that are calling in are talking about colorblind, but I think when Justine is talking about colorblind, she's talking about how she judges people, not so much culturally. And I think that might be not coming across as clearly as we'd all like. But I think it's judging people on an individual basis, colorblind, doesn't look at their racial status first. Looks at their personality, and then, but culturally, I would not say that.
Okay, so now I want to bring in the history of Acadia. Are y'all familiar with the history of the Acadian experience?
The blacks, the slaves that went to the Halifax area, you mean? Or the Acadian, the French Acadian?
Oh, that's just not that area. I'm talking about the Acadia where the Europeans or the French came in. And
are you talking about the area in Canada, though? I mean,
yes, I'm talking about the Acadian experience. Yeah. That's in Canada. The Acadian experiment, which became the Acadian province that had the war with back in the 1700s. You familiar with that?
Broad strokes about the Acadian experience?
Back as
whites
or as do you see the British see the Acadians as whites or non-white?
Well, the British came from a class system, so they applied a class system to a lot of the things, and the class system was inherently racist, not just towards non-whites, but to whites as well. So when they came and colonized Canada, they applied the system they knew from England, which was the class system. So those people were considered inferior because they weren't of a high British class. So, I mean, I guess in that sense, a similar experience, but it's hard for you to say.
You just confused me because your history, because I do history too. You said your history, because the history specifically says to me that they were not just distinct on certain class, it was the color of their skin. So I'm wondering, how does the British who come over are racist against themselves? And at the same time, racist against the Acadians and the first people in your nation.
Everyone,
first
basically
nation
everyone.
People at the same time, which basically they're a mixed race of people, just like Miss Turner is, and they're both doing the same thing. So if they were practicing it, not individually as a group, why would we get suckered into the same situation of practicing it, judging people individually, when the British didn't do that and when society as a whole doesn't do that? Can you explain that for me?
Well, I mean, when you're dealing in an individual, when I deal with an individual, right? I'll acknowledge if they are a different color or different ethnicity than myself, sure. But I'm not going to base my opinions on that person over it. I mean, when you're talking about a societal collective where it's a group of people that you're judging, then you're asking that person's own opinions on those things. And as being, you know, I wasn't around in the 1700s, so I can't say why they would have done that or the way they would have seen it.
You can give your opinion, though. It's okay. You can give your opinion.
My personal opinion on that. I mean, I don't know enough to give an informed opinion. I'll say that first and foremost about that specific Acadian situation. But, you know, they probably would have seen them as inferior, but that was a learned thing that in the British society. So, I mean, wrong all the way through, sure, but they would have just applied a system they'd been taught. And to look at people individually, you know, in an inherently racist society is going to have flaws. But, you know, this is 26, this is 280, sort of 250 years later, right? I mean, we should all be moving past looking at people solely on their race or color or ethnicity. We should look at them as who they are and their actions and then base our opinions off that.
Hang tight, I want to try to run through as many of the callers as I can before we run out of time, just to make sure everybody can at least get one or two questions in really quick. Caller at 2658, good to hear from you, Tapelo. 2658, did you have a quick question for Mark and Justine? You should be with us.
Greetings.
Greetings.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
This first question is for the female guest. I know some of the callers went over it a little bit, but I wanted to make it clear in my mind. Are you biologically connected to both of your parents?
Yes, I am.
Okay. You repeated yourself several times, and you use the metaphor, talk from the heart. Now, I have a background, but hold on, I haven't even asked the question yet.
Pardon? Go ahead.
Okay, can you kind of like be a little bit courteous? It sounds like you're agitated for some reason. I don't know why it is, and I've been listening for a while. I've seen hearts before. The function of a heart is to pump blood. It does not think. So what do you mean when you say talk from the heart?
I talk from the heart. I talk about the heart. I'm talking about the inner soul, right? The heart, thing, the large muscle. But you know what? I'm talking about, I didn't realize I had to talk about the anatomy of the body, but the heart. When someone says about the heart, I mean, you're talking from your inner self. And that's what these individuals did.
Okay, that sounds like a cliche. Inner self. Are you talking about the brain?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that again? It sounds like what?
I said that sounds like because you as I'm listening to you, you keep like either coming up with a cliche or a metaphor, one of the two, and I need clarity. I'm a non-white black male who is a victim of racism and white supremacy, so therefore I need clarity. So I'm trying to ask you a specific question. Are you talking about the brain?
I'm talking about the soul. I'm talking about the soul.
The who?
And the brain's part of the soul. I'm talking about the soul. The soul of a person. The spirit of the person. which is part of the
room. I've seen the insides of bodies, and I've never seen a soul. I've never seen that before. But anyway, let me move on to the next question. Because I don't want to waste the time of the program. You mentioned several times, and you repeated over and over again, that you don't see color. Don't see color, why were you offended when you were called a zebra? A zebra, to a lot of people, is considered to be a beautiful animal.
A beautiful animal.
Can you, ma'am, one of the beautiful animals
of the world.
Can you wait till the person's finished before you, you know? It sounds like you intently want to try to disrupt people. But anyway, I'm going to move forward. You know, a lot of times people are applauded or complimented by using another object that they of beauty. And so I just need to understand from you on why were you offended if someone calls you a zebra? If you are truly what they call blind to racism.
I was offended, my gentleman, because I was in the way they called it to me, and in the way that they would use their hand up it, the way that how they would push down and kick. Not just once, but many times. Okay.
So they said it over. So you responded
many
to
times.
It, right?
Well, yeah, of course I did.
So
I responded by
that
saying, "What do you
mean?" That doesn't sound like someone who is truly blind. But anyway, I'm going to move on.
Excuse me, ma'am.
The gentleman. I have a question for you. Weren't there indigenous people in Canada? A lot of them? I know there's probably still a few right now, but weren't there a whole lot of them?
You mean historically or like?
Yes, sir.
Absolutely. There was a larger population of Aboriginal people.
What happened to them?
Systematic removal of their communities through residential schools. People, essentially white administrative types, telling children, native children, taking them out of their communities and telling them that their culture is worthless and they need to learn the quote-unquote European way to live. The States is known for, like, killing the Aboriginals through wars. And in Canada, it's residential schools that destroy the Aboriginal communities.
Okay, last question, and I'll get off the line. Who exacted this terror? White people or non-white people?
On the Aboriginal community?
Sir, I just...
No, I'm asking, are you saying who, like... Who enacted that
on the indigenous people
community?
That I brought up originally? Who in you stated what you answered my question on mm-hmm. what happened to them, and I'm asking on who exacted this terror that you are explaining?
White people primarily.
Oh, okay.
Power.
Thank you, Gus. Thank you.
Caller from a block number. Did you have a question you wanted to get in?
Greetings.
Greetings
to the guests, greetings to the host, greetings to the listeners. My question for Mr. Turner is...
Ms. Turner or Mr. Drew? Wait a minute.
Mr. Drew, I'm sorry.
Okay.
There was a stat given earlier about a population of black people, and... Mm-hmm. the female guest, she said 3%. You said 25. Oh, no, she said 25.
No, it was the other way around.
Five. Yeah, she said 25, you said 5, and I think Gus said 3. My question is, do you think somebody with such a skewed perception should be talking to anybody? And two, do you think that that skewed perception transferred into the documentary you guys made?
I'm sorry, I'm not exactly sure the context. Are you saying like the 25 to 5 comparison is what you're saying was the skewed view and that was brought? Is that your question?
Yeah, somebody that would give such a has such a skewed perception. Do you think they should be talking to black people or anybody? And do you think that that skewed perception found its way into the documentary that you guys made?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for Justine, but my guess was she would say that it was 25 or such a high percentage because she's actively involved in that community. She sees those people a lot of the times. She lives in those areas in the city where there's a stronger black population. So my guess would be, Justine, you've probably seen that community in larger ways than someone like myself has or someone like the general Londoner would have. Which is why you may think that there's a higher percentage, whereas I would say that I'm going to lean on statistics more. I don't think it made its way into the documentary. You know, we didn't go in there with those racial types of, not stereotypes, but those definitions with people. We really went in there and talked to them. Essentially, you know, we acknowledged that they were black and then we talked about their lives. So it was more we let the people guide the documentary based on what they said. And we really put it together based on the moments we thought they were being the most genuine about themselves, as opposed to making it about a race related conflict, I suppose is the best word.
Do you agree or disagree that her perception is skewed?
On that percentage, yes, but on the general perception, no.
Okay. Ms. Turner, my question for you, I guess, is are you aware that you sound, incoherent and just don't care, or do you think your thoughts are coherent?
I don't feel I sound that way at all. I sound that I'm very proud of what I'm talking about, and that's your point of view. I respect that.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say this is kind of a statement, but yeah, you do sound very. I would rather say incoherent than insane, but like you're not. You don't sound well mentally, like the things you're saying aren't logical, they don't make sense, and it was very hard to listen to both of you guys. I think Mr. Drew knows more. he knows that too, and just has no integrity. But thank you guys for coming on the program. It was very interesting.
Let's see, almost hit all of our callers. Caller dialed in 5640. Did you have a question for Miss Turner, Mr. Drew?
Yeah. Good evening to Gus and to Mr. Drew and Ms. Turner. Ms. Turner, I have a question. What is the texture of your natural hair?
I'm sorry, what's the texture of my natural hair?
Yes, ma'am.
Curly. It's curly.
And is the natural color dark or is it blonde?
It's my natural color. My hair is auburn.
Red. Do you ever wear it out like that way in its natural state?
Sometimes, usually in the summer.
Oh,
it's too hard to straighten my hair. Okay. I like my hair straight.
Oh, you like it straight? Okay.
Yes, I do.
And then the other. Oh, that's great. That's great. The other question I have is, you had earlier you mentioned when you were younger, there were, I think, other biracial folks of black and white parentage who knew that you were also, you know, mulatta. But I wanted to know, in your experiences growing up and in school and in other environments, what were your relationships like with other biracial people of black-white parentage? Did they have the same views that you have in being proud of both mixes, or did you also run into those who preferred the white over the other, or black over the other, or who wanted to pass into white society?
When I was growing up, I had majority of my friends were Caucasian, and I didn't have any friend. I didn't know people that were mulatta until I was going to college. I beg your pardon. No, I did have a friend in high school who was mulatta, and she was adopted actually. Regarding to your question, did they have the same experience as me? My friend Grace, she did. Her parents were Caucasian. And she didn't really have the help that I did as a child, because she actually had the same things that happened to her. But she was actually, her skin color was more on the tan skin, brown skin. So she had it on a different caliber of where they would, you know, call her certain names. But, I would say that I had, I grew up in a generation where it was majority, people that were obviously Caucasian. And, my friends that I had, I didn't see that with them. I would always would be asked by their parents about certain things in my family, and you know, but no, I didn't really have that.
And then lastly, for the gentleman, I think you had mentioned that in Canada, or at least in Canada, or maybe the region where you are in Canada, that whites are more confused about racism. And I believe at one point Gus had a show, or maybe a clip of a young black boy in Canada who was relentlessly teased by all-white classmates and called the N-word. And he's basically the only black person in his school, and these are young children taunting him. So obviously those children have an idea of race and have this disdain for, you know, for blackness. So I wanted to get your response on that, and I don't know if you've heard about that, or I don't know if Gus, you know, might have the show in question, and you can listen to that.
Well, I mean, I'm not aware of the specific incident you're talking about, but it does sound, you know, it's not the first type of incident like that I've read about in Canada. You know, I would say that type of behavior from those white students, I don't know how the age range, do you know how old these kids were? Like, are we talking under 10 years old or something? Okay, yeah, I mean, in that scenario, I would say a lot of it probably is what they're being taught by their parents, that they're taking that attitude, right? I mean, if you put a bunch of children in the room together with no context of each other, they're not going to look as a child that's black versus a child that's white, Muslim, whatever, right? They're not going to care, because they don't really understand those concepts completely. I think that's probably a learned behavior taught, you know, or something that they're hearing in their homes or, you know, close communities that's forming that kind of negative opinion. I mean, it's a problem. I'll give you that for sure.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but do you think you're, like, letting those kids off the white children that are taunting him off the hook? Because it seems that just about almost every black person, at least that's visibly black, you know, they're taunted by white children when they're younger, and the white children will call them the N-word. and whether they're playing outside or in school. And so I respect your answer, but I just kind of feel that it's as though you're just letting them kind of off the hook and you know, finding an excuse for their behavior when clearly they can say it out of their mouth and they know the difference because the person has darker skin, mm-hmm. that they feel the right to say that. But anyway, thank you so much to you both, Ms. Turner and the gentleman. I wish you the best. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess I can respond to that if there's enough time, Gus. Or,
sure.
I mean, I'm not excusing the behavior by any means, right? Like, if anything, it's the teacher, you know, that should be correcting that type of behavior when they hear it. Because it's not acceptable, obviously, but at the same time, like, they had to learn it from somewhere, so I'm more interested in where did they learn it, and how do we stop them from learning that type of attitude so that it doesn't happen at the beginning. You know, I think the experience that blacks have with racism in Canada is probably not unique in the sense that a lot of minorities in Canada have a similar racial experience with whites. Not to say all whites are that way, because I think it's a small minority of whites that act this way and, like I said earlier, ruin it for the rest of us. But, you know, it's behavior, right, that's taught somewhere. And if we can find where it's being taught and stop it at the source, I see that as a more long-term solution to this as opposed to chastising children for things they, you know, maybe they know the difference, but they're not clear on what they're accusing these other children of because they don't understand at that age themselves, let alone the history and the stigmatism that is behind racism. They just are being taught things that are inherently wrong.
Hold on. Ross, I think we have two callers left and we'll have hit everybody. Ross, did you have a question you wanted to get in for Ms. Turner, Mr. Drew?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to Mr. Drew and to Mrs. Turner. Yes, I had a couple questions for both guests. For Mr. Drew, I wanted to know, does Canada have the one drop rule like they do in the United States, where if you have one drop of black blood, they consider you black, or is that non-existent?
I can't say for sure that is, but it sounds like a policy that would probably be put in place here.
Okay, thank you. My next question would be, this is also for you, Mr. Drew. Does Canada use racial classification in any area of people activity? Like, is there any sort of scenario in Canada where they will ask you for your racial classification?
I believe on citizenship-related documents, when you're dealing with the federal government here, there might be some documents where they call it your ethnicity. And then it has a list like white, black, or I think it's Caucasian, African American, and then Muslim and so on, Aboriginal, et cetera. It's not just like white or black so much as it's most of our visible minority here, I would say right now, is Muslim, followed by Aboriginal, followed by black. So it's kind of a mix that we see here.
Okay, thank you so much. And for Mrs. Turner, my first question would be, did your parents raise you to view yourself as a biracial person, or was that a personal choice of self-classification? The reason I ask is because Halle Berry has a black father and a white mother, and she's basically about in a similar age range to you, and her mother always raised her as a black female, understanding that in America she would be treated and viewed as a black female. So I just wanted to know, like, whereas nowadays I think the mixed race classification is becoming vogue, whereas in older days it wasn't like that. So I just wanted to know, was that a self-choice, or did your parents raise you that way?
My parents raised me that way. And as become an adult, you know, you have choices, right? And I didn't have a choice because I just knew who I was. But I can't dismiss one side of me that made me, or the other side of me that made me. So I was raised to be who I am.
Thank you so much for that answer. And the last two questions are for both of you. The first one is, do you think that non-white people can be racist? And why?
Absolutely.
Non-white people.
Do you want to go ahead, Justine? I think racism is not just a white problem. I think it's a cultural problem. When you look at certain cultures, I mean, this is going to be an extreme example, but ISIS, right? They're very racist in the way they act, and they're racist against everyone that doesn't follow their doctrine. I see that in a very similar way to whites being racist against blacks systematically. It's a system problem, not so much just a white versus non-white problem. I think anyone can be racist in the right scenario, and it doesn't really matter your ethnicity. I think it's just if you're black and intolerant to white, that's racist in the same way that a white is intolerant to a black person on an individual level. On a societal level, it's different. But it's very possible for people that are not white to be racist towards anyone.
And go ahead, Justine, Mr. Turner.
You know, I agree. Exactly. I agree with what Mark just said. It's up to the individual, right? So.
Okay. I would say I disagree, because my research has showed me that the only people who have the power to really behave in a racist manner systematically and deprive people of access to health care and proper education and housing are white people over non-white people. ISIS is more of I wouldn't even call them racist either. I would just say they're people of Arabic descent who seem to want to consolidate the Arab area into under their domination, but I wouldn't call that racism per se. My final question to both of you would be, would you say that racism is white culture? The reason I ask is because if white people really wished for racism to end, they could end it literally overnight by just treating people properly and treating them with dignity and respect and justice. But they choose to continuously create all of these issues and create more confusion in the way that they dominate non-white people, and I believe that the problem would have been solved if white people truly, if racism was not their culture. I believe we're still dealing with this problem because it is their culture, and I would just like to get your take on that, and with that, I'll mute my line. Thank you both very much for being on the program.
Regarding white people, so you're saying that whites are the ones that create the racism? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I was asking, do you believe or would you agree with the statement that racism is white culture? Just simply because if they wish to stop mistreating non-white people, they could do so in an instant. But because we've been dealing with this, at least in America, for the last 500 years, this speaks to the fact that this is a cultural issue where this is just the way that white people function on a regular basis, in my opinion. So I just wanted to know, would you agree with that statement that racism is white culture? If not, why? And if so, why? Thank you.
Racism is not about white culture. It's white culture, but it's other cultures too that create racism. Whether it's your economic status, you know, where you live, where you go to school, what you wear. You know, obviously, bottom line, you know, racism started by the whites, and you know, it's been cast down generation after generation, but it's been embedded into all different races and cultures. So, you know, it's up to everyone to stop racism. That's the bottom line. It's not just the whites, it's everybody.
Well, would you say that because you believe everybody's racist, We have been inculcated with that culture by white people who are basically the origin of racism, white supremacy. So basically our behavior is a reflection of the treatment we've had with white people since we've had first contact with them. So even the problems you're describing are byproducts of racism, white supremacy, which is, to me, Europe's most valuable export that they've ever had.
You said Europe's what?
Biggest export.
Europe's most valuable export has been racism, white supremacy, in my opinion, because of their ability to dominate non-white people for such a long period of time and continue to get away with it. And again, like I said, if they wanted to stop racism, they can literally wake up tomorrow and say, we're going to stop gunning down unarmed black males in the street. The cab drivers will say, I'll stop and pick up people with equality. None of this is happening because I believe white people are inherently racist. If they were not, we would have solved this problem a long time ago.
Okay, so if they stop today, it still continues because it's embedded in people. It's embedded in different races around the globe. So can it stop? Well, there's going to be has to be a major movement of unity, and that's what needs to be done.
Right on. We'll get our last caller in. Last caller, the caller at 9298. Did you have a question for Justine? Mark, you should be with us.
Yep. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone on the line. I have 5 questions, Gus. I don't know if that's okay, if you want me to narrow it down.
Let's just see if we can get them in quickly.
Okay. So I am on Facebook, and I am looking at a website. I don't know if it's your website, ma'am. It's Finding Freedom in the Forest City. Is that your Facebook page?
Yes, it is. That's correct.
Okay. I had a question about a person featured in your documentary. His name is Joey Hollingsworth.
Joey Hollingsworth.
Is that correct? Okay.
Yes.
I'm noticing on 2 of his pictures that there's a picture of him as a 5-year-old with a white suit and a tap dancing, and there's a picture of him, you scroll up, and another white suit, obviously an adult. You can see a huge color contrast. Did you ask him about that? The picture was taken when he was 5 in 1941. Did you, at elementary school, did you reference that or ask him why there was such a huge color contrast?
No, I never even thought about asking that.
Okay.
I can give kind of a technical explanation. We got that photo after the interview, so it was just what was provided to us. We never had the opportunity to look at it before or during the interview.
Okay. Yeah, because he looks like himself a biracial quote unquote child. It doesn't look like the same person. And I know color can change over time, but that it's very drastic. So my next question is, and this is to the both of you. You were making for the female on the line. You were saying that everyone needs to stop racism. So I want to ask both of you, how can black people stop racism?
Black people mindset. Worldwide.
I'm sorry, both of you both said something, so I wasn't able to hear correctly.
Go ahead, Mark.
Oh, I was just asking. You mean black people worldwide, or like American blacks, or like a specific, or a general?
If you want to narrow it down to American and Canada, that's fine. Worldwide, however in depth you want to go.
It's hard to say worldwide, right? Because there's a lot of different cultures that interact in very different ways compared to the American, Canadian, black experience, I suppose. The African black experience is vastly different, as we know. What I can say is the Black Lives Matter kind of protest is a good first step, but it's only the first step, right? I mean, pointing out these injustices is the first way to get society aware that these things continue to happen. But then I think what needs to happen is an encouragement of not just whites and only blacks, or but everybody, to start demanding more of their authorities, like the police force. I know that's the chief perpetrator in terms of black injustice right now that Black Lives Matter is fighting about. But I don't want to just say police only. I mean, I would say more the authority, like government and police and any, you know, jail systems, all of those things are part of this problem, right? Where it's to change that, we have to change the way society looks at races, not racism, and realize, right, that, you know, ultimately we all have the same kind of goals and aspirations. It really doesn't make a difference what color our skin is. We're all just trying to make it in the world. And when the injustices happen, we need to point that out, and we need to demand more from our authority and more from our government to stop these types of actions happening in the first place. And maybe that's, I think education's a big part of it, but it's not the only thing. It's a lot of collective things that need to happen. You know, keep fighting, really. Honestly, I think that the fight's only just begun as opposed to nearing its end.
Okay, thank you. And I'd like to definitely hear from your partner in the film. How do you think that black people can stop racism?
It's a mindset. It's all about the situation you have that's given to you at the time, and it's hard. It's easier said than done. I do know that, but mindset, and know that overlook it and go to the root of what's going on, and do your best to be as kind and loving as you can. Now, if someone's being very rude to you, you can't, you know, you gotta stand up for yourself. But take yourself away from that, you know. But it's a mindset, and just to realize the root and know that if they're being like that towards you, you know they're very inferior and very insecure. And
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's okay. It's overlook. It's okay. All good.
Did you want to add anything else to that, or?
I was just saying, just to overlook it and just know that you have power. You have power within you. And that power is love. But it's hard to have that love sometimes. I understand that. But you have that power, and just know that who you are, and embrace that, and keep on keeping on.
In regards to that, the gentleman, he stated to keep fighting. You said stand up, overlook it, and to love. I had an incident where I was hit at the job. How should I have fought that? Should I have physically fought her? Or should I have stood up? Should I have overlooked it? Or should I have given her love? And this was from a white woman who hit me.
What happened to you?
She physically struck you?
She physically struck me on the job. I was being trained by two white women, and two other white women were my superiors. She hit me on the hand as to chastise me like a child, not to touch something, even though it was in my job duties to touch that thing. So when you use key terms such as pointing out these injustices, keep fighting, stand up, overlook, and to love, how should I have stood up or kept fighting when this woman hit me on the job? Or should I have loved and overlooked during that instance?
I can't say, you know, right, with authority based on your experience, right? But what you've told me, you know, the way I would react if I was in that situation was I would tell that person that struck me that you know, I find that behavior unacceptable. You know, it's a modern society. We should not be striking people. If you have an issue with me, then you tell me, that type of thing, or an issue with my actions, then you tell me. You do not physically harm me. I mean, I will never advocate violence. I'm a very peace-loving person. So I would never say go and fight back, at least not physically. But, you know, I would maybe once, if it happened once, I would tell them, you know, that kind of behavior I don't find acceptable. It's not appropriate. You know, I'm willing to look the other way about the physical side right now, but I never want to see this type of action again from you, or we'll have a real problem. And then if it happens again, I would start formal, you know, if she struck me again, I would press charges at that point, because you'd made it clear, right, that you don't accept that kind of physical altercation. You know, again, I can't give you proper advice, right, only knowing that scenario. I don't know the person, but based on my reaction, right, anyone striking anyone is an inappropriate behavior, regardless of it's black or white or white or black or black. That type of action is just, in a modern society, not acceptable. And that's what I would point out to that person, first and foremost. And then if it happened again, I would start more formal procedures in a way to, I'm not saying compensation, but a way that would, you know, the system realizing what's going on. And that would probably be through legal action or some sort of grievance.
Okay.
Again, though, I know the system is stacked against, I assume you're black, I take it, like,
yes,
like you're visibly black. Yeah, I mean, I know then it's probably much more difficult to go and stand on that platform. Well, I'd assumed. You know, I know it's harder, especially for blacks and women, to stand up in that scenario when something wrong is being done to them. But if no one does, then it'll never stop.
Right on. Okay. We will leave it there. I know you had a few other questions you wanted to get in, but we are getting down on time.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Thanks to all the folks who dialed in with their questions. Hope you got some constructive commentary from Mark Drew, Justine Turner. Again, if you need additional, if you want to see Justine Turner, because that came up, that was a discussed aspect of the program this evening, you can go to the website, findingfreedomintheforestcity.com. It's linked in the description to the program. I think I posted it on Facebook as well, but you can go there and you can get more details about the film. I know we have listeners that are in the Ontario area. If you're interested in the screening, if you go to the website, you'll see screenings that they have scheduled for later this year. So if you are close and you want to go check it out, they might even have some Q&A sessions where you can see the film and then get in a few questions for the folks that we have that are close to the London, Ontario area. Hit the website, and then you can come back and let us know if you go check out the experience. It has been fascinating. Mark and Justine, enjoyed having you both on the program with us for the exchange. Anything you all want to say before we close things out?
I'd say, you know, if any of your viewers want to get in touch with me and talk more, feel free to send them my email. I believe you do have that.
Yes, sir, I do.
So I'm absolutely open to people sending me messages and having a conversation that continues through email.
Cool in the game. Justine, anything?
Hi, guys. You know, thank you for having us on your program. It's been truly an experience. And, you know, good luck with what you're doing. And just, you know, remember, we're all one race, right? We're the human race, and it's been great. And I'm really, really proud and very, very thankful to God that we had this film that came out, Finding Freedom in the Forest City.
For sure. Thanks to the both of you. Again, we will be looking forward. If I get any feedback from folks who are able to check out the future film screenings, I will let you know. Thank you to Mark for getting me a copy of the film. I will be sure not to copy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you kindly, and enjoy the rest of your Thursday evening.
Yeah, thanks very much, Gus. I appreciate you having us.
For sure. Evening to both of you. Evening to both of you.
Take care.
Yes, sir.
context of white supremacy. Wow, I think we actually did get all of our callers in. That was a chore in and of itself, but I think we got everybody. Thanks to all the folks who called. Glad to hear folks dial in from north of the border. Good to hear they got some of their questions in. I don't even think we got all of our Canadian listeners, but I think we at least did get a good chunk of them. Again, we should be back tomorrow. Book club, Harriet Washington, Medical Apartheid, fascinating book, extremely important scholarship. Same program time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I'll be looking forward to starting a new book with you all tomorrow. If folks have anything quick that they want to get in before we wrap up, we should have a few moments. I try generally to make sure we have a cushion of 10 minutes or so if there's anything significant folks want to share before we wrap things up. I know sometimes people will want to discuss a review or make a point about what they have heard during the course of the program, and then if we go all the way to the three hour mark, excuse me, then we don't really have time to do that. I know we had one listener, who wrote in, and they had an observation that they wanted to share. I'll just read their commentary. I can pull it up really quick. They wrote in, there we go. All right, so they wrote in, just as a caveat, based on talking about Justine, emotional response, based on her emotional responses to our questions, I believe that may have played a role in the individuals that were being interviewed in the documentary not being truthful. I could be wrong, but if the individuals interviewed knew of her or know individuals who have talked with her, maybe they may have known to go along with the narrative that she laid out in the film. That was one of her observations. I know one of the things that stood out for me, I was reminded, the legend, Tater Pie, she's been on the program repeatedly throughout the years. When we first came back on the air in 2009, when the Cows first started 07, we started with the intent of playing music, and we were just going to kind of talk about racism as kind of a filler or in between songs, you know, play 3, 4, 5 songs or what have you, and then maybe have a sentence or two about racism and then back to the music. That was the original intent, not to just have talk radio about white supremacy. And as we were transitioning back of the bus and Gus, as we were transitioning to talking about racism full time, and having a talk radio program about white supremacy, we still had music kind of playing in the background where you could hear it while we were talking. And I was so disappointed because when we came back to the air, I was not able to do that. That was something I couldn't resurrect, and I was really, you know, disgruntled about it. And Tater Pie was like, are you crazy? Like, how are you going to have, like, serious conversation about anything, much less white supremacy, and have, right, like, so you have Dr. Welsing on the program, what music are you going to play while Dr. Welsing is speaking? And just as the guy was just like, yeah, that's probably true. She was like, what serious talk radio programs do you know where they have music playing in the background? And it's like, yeah, point well taken. And as we continued, when we started to have more programs, particularly having programs with white guests, where there was hostility, conflict, where it became a bit more contentious, it became very important to be able to hear everything. When they start to get upset and that sort of thing, they're breathing harder, it just became a lot more important. And I was reminded of that today, talking with Justine. I can only say this is a great illustration of why I use the term suspected racist. I know some people are not fans of that. They're like, you know, there's no such thing as a suspected racist. Either you are or you are not a white supremacist. There's no suspects involved. It's just you don't have enough information or whatever the case is, but there is no such thing as a suspect. Either you are or you are not. This is one of the times where I see the utility of suspected racist. For me, Justine Turner, she would not go down as quote-unquote mulatta or quote-unquote biracist. biracial, or any of the other terms that she pulled out, or any new terms that may be created down the road, she would just be on the suspected racist list. The way that she responded to questions, most of her answers throughout the dialogue sounds exactly like what I have heard from racists, racist white women who've been on this program and that I've just heard from in years past. Some might say, well, you know, there are victims of racism who are the complexion of Dick Gregory or Lupita Nyong'o or Viola Davis who might give the same response. That is true. It is a very different thing when you are giving those type of responses and you actually look like you could be accepted as white, which she does. That is a very different thing. I'm not going to be fooled, or I'm going to make every effort to not be fooled about that sort of thing. You would have to be in the racist suspect list. That's the way that I would classify her. That's the way that I would think about her. That's the way that I would function in relation to her, that this is someone who could be accepted as white and is just trying to fool us, fool me, whatever the case may be. I'm going to act as though she is on team white supremacy racist woman, and I'll just keep that in mind when I'm functioning around her. I've met other people that are in this category who they have a, and she might, that might not even be true. Some people that wrote in about that as well. Even if we take it for granted that that is accurate, still, I'm just going to function with you as a racist suspect. At minimum, this would be another reminder of why astronomically significant. Anyone, if you are confused or don't grasp why it's important, if it's, we're talking about a non-white person who has a white parent, anybody out there who's listening, if you think Justine Turner, if you think she's a non-white female, you believe that, okay, fine, no problem. I would say it is astronomically significant that she does have a white parent, if nothing else, for the way that she looks phenotypically. And then you can factor in everything else in terms of her views and what she does, the way that she talks about racism. But that alone, the way that she looks, extremely important that she has a white parent. I know that's something we've been talking about a bit of late as well. We have 10 minutes. So if folks have any concise comments they want to get in before we conclude, feel free to do so. I guess if anybody thought that she is non-white, we can get that in. That would be great. Anybody who thinks, yeah, I just think she's a non-white person who's super confused, who happens to be a bit on the pale side, please get that in as well. Yes, lady, we could hear you.
While we were having a discussion with her, I looked online, I looked, on her website, on her, on YouTube. I think that her appearance is intentional. I think she may be very lighter complected, but I think that this woman is going a little bit further to look white. And she may be even bleaching. I don't really know. It just, she does not, this does not, her color does not look natural, especially with her dyeing her hair. Then the way she styles herself is to me, in an effort to look more like a white woman. I don't know how far she's going, but that's just what I'm getting. She's very confused. I think it is because she has a white mother, especially. I'm pretty sure her mother probably whispers the things that my nephew, my brother has five children by a white woman, whispers into the youngest child's ear. The palest child's ear, that you are my white baby because you can see his veins. I wonder if her mother whispered that in her ear when she was around too, or something like that. I don't understand anything this woman was talking about. I don't understand her point of doing what she was doing, and I hope that she listens to this broadcast and reevaluates why she is speaking on race, why she's making films on race, and how to better project herself, because she is confusing me, and she sounds very confused herself. And I wish I could have asked more questions, and I'll leave it at that.
Can I be heard?
Hello?
Yes, sir. I heard two people. We'll take Thomas in New York, then we'll get the other caller.
I'll be real quick. I apologize. And don't forget that her mixed-race parent is not a full black father. She said her father was mixed race. So that plays into it a lot, probably why she is. I think probably back in the day she would have been a quintuple or a cinquuple, whatever they would have had, you know, labeled for her. But she was very deceptive and very confusing. And you could look at the picture and see it's no way that a mixed race person would have hair that color or that straight, you know. So she's very Lacey Swartz-ish, how her mother, you know, probably, you know, straightened her hair and got her the contacts, you know, to really fit her into that white class. And I'll mute my line thinking. Oh, Gus, another one that's in the puff.
Right.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. If she is a mulatto, she is, to me, is the perfect machine for the white supremacy and the, if anybody's seen the movie Rabbit Proof Fence, or even the movie Australia, where they created the mixed race, the buffer race, she is the exact, what's that word I'm looking for, the product of what they were trying to do to confuse the native populations, the Aboriginal population. She's teaching black history and wants to be colorblind. It doesn't make any sense. How are you going to judge a person individually when you're being judged and you're just teaching this class? And then you, in your appearance, you want to look like a Barbie. You want to look like a white Barbie. And you want to teach black history to somebody. It's just total contradiction. And you're showing these black children, because that's who you teach in black history, and you're showing these black children how marginalized their life is. And yes, they're going to be white identified. Yes. So it's a total contradiction. I also want to ask, how many black businesses was in her area? I mean, since she talked about how, you know, they're over it, I want to know how many black businesses are in the area and how well are they doing? Have they built a community properly? Do they run their own school? Are they in control of their own, you know, resources? You know, can we name all the areas of activity do they control? And I'll mute my line there because I came in kind of 30 minutes late, I believe. So I didn't hear if she did answer it, if she did. Right,
I'm can I be up? I'm sorry.
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Yes, I just wanted to get in really quickly. I would agree with the with Lady. She seems to definitely, I don't even think she realizes how insidious racism, white supremacy is, just with the whole hair situation, dyeing her hair blonde, straightening her hair. Everything about her is, I think, a quintessential example of what racists do as far as creating that buffer class and how they function to facilitate racism and white supremacy. Also, the male guest said something that really threw me off. At one point, he said that every society has flaws, and he implied that racism was a flaw in the society. And I'm like, racism is a system. It's not a flaw. And I believe he was practicing racism a couple of times throughout the program, but that specifically stood out for him to refer to racism as a societal flaw. And with Mrs. Turner, I just think she's just a quintessential example of why mixed race relationships are a no-no. Like the confusion, the colorblind, all of that stuff is just fodder for white supremacists to continue to confuse non-white people, and especially those that are products of mixed race relationships. And I said mixed race because that's what I believe it is. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
The caller at 0462, did you have a comment you wanted to get in?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I will. Just how he is a white female, and this is some kind of trick to help confuse us more, and that's all I have to say.
Hey, Gus, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Gus, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how you doing?
I got a question.
All right. I just
909, go first, and then I'll get the vote caller.
Oh, okay, thank you, sir. I didn't want to hang up. I know you probably wouldn't have mind, but I felt like it was a little disrespectful for me to hang up for some reason or whatever. But and I kind of wanted to tell you something about Vice. But at the same time, I was thinking, I don't think I heard anything cogent that she said. And saying that, like with the statistic about the 25%, like that's a little, you know, that's not a person that really understands even the subject. I mean, you're not even in the ballpark of understanding, like, even the population of the people that you're trying to talk about. Like that was a little weird, and I didn't hear anything, like I said, cogent that she said. So my question to you is, because I'm kind of curious about it, I could be wrong, but it seemed like the questions, it seemed like her incoherence was like rubbing off a little bit or something. Like I'm just asking, like, okay, she sounded insane. So like asking a person like that question after question after question after question, like it was like, I was like, man, we're, you know, black people are masochists or something like that. You know, it was just, I had to put the phone down. And I'm just kept thinking, like, are we masochists? Like, are we, you know, we enjoy it? So, like in situations like that where the person is just not making any sense at all, is it constructive to keep asking them questions? And it just seemed very weird to me. What do you think?
I think I say all the time, monitor your time and energy. I say that not just in reference to this program, but in general, in terms of making sure that we're not wasting time. We have too many problems to be wasting time. I think, at least with her, we've had a lot of white people, racist suspects on the program, even a lot of victims, who, when asked questions about racism, white supremacy, their responses are not logical, and or not accurate, either because they are confused or they're just deliberately trying to practice racism. I think that happens frequently with regards to dealing with racism, white supremacy, and questioning white people or individuals who could be white or even confused victims. So I think that's not an irregularity. I think with her, I think some of it was just just trying to see if people, I think some people just were trying to see if they could get some clarity around her saying that she didn't see color and the absurdity of that, and asking questions, I think, just to further reveal the just the inaccuracy and the deception of that. And then around her her racial classification, because it seemed like there were a good number of questions about that, her hair texture and that sort of thing, and where she got that even thought process from. So I think that was some of the folks just trying to see if they could get some clarity, because so much of it was not making sense, a lot of rhetoric, I think that was pointed out as well, just trying to see if they could cut through that. And I think that's going to be your task frequently with regards to racism, white supremacy, trying to cut through nonsense, see if you can get some clarity. And even, hey, I think sometimes you have to make a decision that I'm not going to be able to get any clarity here. Moving forward, I'll talk to somebody else or do my own research or whatever the case may be. That has to be done as well sometimes.
I agree. I just wanted to remind people like you said, monitor your time. And I mean, just wanted to kind of put that out there that, you know, I don't know if that, I don't know. I think people understand where I'm coming from. I think a lot of those questions were, I didn't get any indication that she could answer any of those questions. Like, it was just very arduous and torturous. But, you mentioned Vice. If there's a Women in Marijuana, they have big time stake in marijuana, and there's a documentary on Vice, and one of the women says in that they're sending out marijuana to feminize males. Man, it was the illest documentary I've ever seen. I had no idea that white women were balling like that, growers, acres upon acres, like big business. In that, and they're like witches, and they said that they are sending out the marijuana bud to
feminize men.
Fascinating. Weeds, that was a popular program that was on for, I think, about almost a decade, nearly, with a white woman being the cannabis queen with her empire and pushing out her narcotics. I'll be sure to check it out. The Vote caller, you were going to comment?
Yeah, this is Eastbrook calling from Atlanta, Canada. I called in earlier. I grew up on the west coast of Africa. And so I think while from a North American perspective, there's all these issues about color and how someone looks, which is so important in dealing with white supremacy. But I think it is important to deal with the ideology of the shit someone's saying. The stuff she was saying didn't make any sense. It makes sense if you accept white supremacy. It doesn't make sense if you actually accept the reality that white people are not superior. If you accept the reality that, you know, color actually exists. And you can see it. She was able to dye her hair. If she couldn't see color, she wouldn't be able to figure out what color she was dyeing her hair. She doesn't understand what racism is. She was confused about what racism, and the other guy that was recording, that the video camera guy, also was confused about what racism is. They're thinking prejudice, you know. Prejudice and racism, and, you know, racism is prejudice plus power. It's a global system of domination. And she had a problem saying the word white. How are you going to deal with black history and have it, and not be able to say the word white? You know, so it's a very, it's like the Columbus idea of where people just believe that they have a superior understanding of something, even though they don't know jack. And then they feel that they're in a position to be able to teach. So it's like the ignorant leading the ignorant. And we see that in some of our brothers and sisters too, who have taken this whole ideology and accepted it as reality and are teaching the same nonsense. I see that from black people too. So the issue is white supremacy. And she's practicing that. Well-meaning, but still practicing it. Back in the day, it was easier to deal with the KKK because you knew they wanted to kill you and they told you that. Problem with the nice ones is that they think that they love you. They actually believe that they love you, but the shit that they bring in towards you is going to kill you. And that's more sinister to deal with, and that's what we're dealing with in Canada, with the well-meaning white Muslims or cognitive people. Is that making any sense?
It's still kind of a challenge. Your line is not the clearest, but I think I was able to pick out most of it. I guess the only thing I would add on that, and I've seen this from a number of people where I had no confusion or ambiguity about their racial classification, that these were individuals who were white. They identified as white, and there didn't seem to be any confusion about that. I just have taken the position that frequently when they are talking and being illogical, incoherent, inaccurate in the way that they talk about racism, white supremacy, it's not that they don't understand. It's not that they don't have information about this. It's just that they're not supposed to speak accurately about it when they're talking to victims. And I just try to point out with our listeners, those are two very different things. Having people who are not informed about racism, as opposed to having people who are deliberately giving false, inaccurate information about racism, or even if they are giving accurate information, they do it in a very convoluted manner so that you can't easily grasp what's being said. And I've just concluded that that's one of the really insidious ways that whites often practice racism, by pretending that they're ignorant. I think that was even said. That's been one of the things I say on the program all the time. This notion that white people are ignorant about racism is simply not true. And I, at least for Mr. Drew, because he did identify as white, I've seen images of him. I don't think there's any confusion about his status, his classification. Even amongst his responses and what have you, I think 909 didn't say that he thought he was ignorant. He said, I don't think he has any integrity. To me, that suggests I don't think this person is being honest in speaking with us. And I'm saying that I think the same thing could be true with Ms. Turner. I guess it would just depend on if you think
this is someone who's able to be accepted as white and function as a white person, or if we just think this is a confused victim, and, you know, you can come to your own conclusions about that. But, yeah, I'm not even willing to concede that these are quote-unquote well-meaning whites. I'm suggesting that these could just be racist white supremacists out doing a great job of confusing us about racism, what the issue is, how it works, and cranking out this documentary that's supposed to be helpful, and it's not at all. I was even going to tell folks, I was going to recommend for people in Toronto, if you wanted to go see the film or whatever, I couldn't even suggest that you do so. It's just not, it's an hour. It really wouldn't be worthy of your time and energy to go check out. It's, you know, you're not really going to learn anything about white supremacy, and it wouldn't be really worthy investment of your time. Do we have anybody who had not shared?
I hear you. I live with.
Hang on 1 second. Do we have anybody who had not shared at all, who had a comment that they wanted to get in?
Well, I wanted to get in a comment.
Yes,
this is, it kind of like reinforces the incorrectness of metaphors and cliches. This is something that if it's a white person, they are deliberately doing it to confuse non-white people. As I was attempting to get more and more concise, meant out of the guests, she kept going more and more into cliches, talking about a soul, and I've been into the organs of people, and I never saw a soul. It's not identified in any medical a book. You know, this is where your soul is. It's over here. You know, a heart. It only does one thing that I know about. It's pumped blood through the body. It doesn't think at all, you know, so her talking from the heart, you know, that sort of thing. And it's not unusual that white people talk to us like we're children, like you hear sometimes adults telling fairy tales and quote unquote fairy tales and things of that nature, and that's just what it sounded like tonight. It sounded like that, you know, thoroughly, very consistently, from that standpoint. Don't see color. Well, if you don't see color, why would you be offended when somebody calls your name? I mean, you would even know that a zebra is considered to be something, considered to be an insult, a racial insult, if you didn't see color, you know, as far as that's concerned, you know, and even if it did, if you did know what it was, with this training that she claimed that she was getting from her parents, then the whole thing about ignoring it and not reacting to it would have been the actual antidote. So, you know, that was basically deliberate untruth that she was talking about from don't see color. And I want to say insulting our intelligence, but, you know, it's probably that or, like I said, a deliberate act of racism. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We'll end our other caller in Canada. Do you have anything you want to get in, our other caller in Toronto area?
Yeah, I just wanted to apologize again for that. I think the other caller was right. I guess her incoherence really warped me a lot. But I do think overall that she exemplifies why interracial dating, tragic arrangements, are just only serving white supremacy. And I think it's just, she's a classic case. And I would also add transracial adoptions onto that because it's the same effect anyways. And I think the only reason why she's getting so much support behind this documentary is because she's white. And that's why she can play colorblind. And I also think that she just wants to have black when it's convenient for her and white when it's convenient for her. That's exactly what it is. You want to do black when you're talking about black people, but you want to be white in everything else. That's what it is.
Mm.
Oh, she's white, by the way.
Right on.
folks can come to their own conclusion on that. And that's when I don't waste any time arguing about either, because at the end of the day, very important to remember, white people do the classifying. I am not white, so this is just my opinion, which is not worth very much on the plantation. But just, you know, come to your own conclusions about that sort of thing, because that is a major weapon of racism, white supremacy. Again, just her emotional responses to me were very, very revealing at the very beginning of the program. I almost felt like we might have had a hang-up coming, that she was going to be, I'm done. You're not going to impugn me. I've told you I'm a mulatto woman and biracial and all the other stuff. I thought that might have been on the horizon, but she and her partner, Drew, film partner, they hung in and stayed for the duration. If folks have any follow-ups, comments, thoughts, feel free to drop a line. I posted, for people that are on my Facebook, I posted more pictures of her. I think there are about four or five, so you can see a lot of different pictures of her, some of her where her hair looks a little different and that sort of thing, different links, all that. So you can check out more photographs of her if you want to get, you know, more information to try to come to conclusions about her racial status and what's going on there, if you are so interested. If not, we'll be here tomorrow. Medical Apartheid, session number one. I'm very excited. Harriet Washington, phenomenal scholarship, the history of white supremacy, white terrorism in the medical field. Wowee. Looking forward. Long time coming, but 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be on this book for a while. It's a lengthier book. It's like a history, as I said before. It's like Half Has Never Been Told type book. But I think extremely important. Thinking caps on. Be ready to roll. We'll start it tomorrow, and the compensatory call-in should be Saturday. I think we have Sunday off. And then we should be here on Monday. Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson will be back with us. And then Tuesday, we'll have another program where we're talking about the importance of black parenting and how you deal with the school system. She is a black scholar in education in Pennsylvania, Dr. Maazma. I hope I'm saying her name correctly. She's a black female. She should be here Tuesday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. She's written about homeschooling specifically for black parents and the importance of that. So stay tuned, particularly for black parents. Stay tuned. Lots of broadcasting coming up for the next, I guess, as we close out April. If you have any problems, gripes, questions, complaints, feel free. UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. I hope the program was worthy of your time and energy this Thursday evening. Lord knows we could have all been doing other things with our time. It's been historically immaculate weather here in the Washington State area. We had three consecutive days of 80 degree weather. That has never happened in April. It was three consecutive days of record setting sunshine. And even today, we didn't break a record. We had to labor through like a 73 degree sunny day. We had to suffer through that today. It's just been extraordinary. So certainly Gus T could have been doing other things. Hopefully it was of some constructive value, and we'll try again tomorrow, even if folks didn't learn anything or get anything useful. Again, sobriety, given what we just heard from 909, sobriety would be best under conditions of racism, white supremacy. Certainly the economics of it would be enough to say we're not going to spend a nickel on any white narcotics, white poisons, white chemicals until this problem has been solved. Certainly you do not want to be behind the wheel, driver, passenger, or pedestrian, and under the influence. You never know when it's going to be Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any of these other race soldiers who is pulling you over. Your life could be over, literally and figuratively. Certainly you want to do the best that you can to keep yourself safe, you, anybody else that you might be responsible for. Buckle up if you're going to be in the vehicle. Again, that goes for driver or passengers. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.